Justice and Women's Wellness, opening up a subcommittee. So, Representative Cowan.
Yes, ma'am.
You want to talk with us about an update on Subcommittee on Seniors and People with Disabilities.
Thank you. Just to give a brief update, I think that we all know where LC 28, what the basic structure of that bill is. It is moving forward. It has moved through the Senate Committee on Seniors and People with Disability and is currently being, drafted into its final format. The Is James here this morning? Yeah, could you ask him to come in? I'm going to ask James Taves to come up in case he'd like to add a little bit to what I'm about to say here. The substance of the bill is still in a three-part format, the first section being to increase the rates for seniors and people with physical disabilities in what I call the mid-level facilities, assisted living facilities, residential care, and adult foster care. And the reasoning behind that is because we are seeing a trend towards facilities that are in the public-private market, if you will, that have predominantly private clients choosing to deny access to Medicaid clients or choosing to no longer serve Medicaid clients. And that then forces those individuals to be placed in nursing homes, which might be a higher level of care than their needs dictate in any given time. So we feel that if we can do a little bit of a rate increase, which the Department of Human Services feels can be accommodated within their rebalance, that we can make a first step in slowing or stopping that trend and maintaining access for our elderly population. The second piece of the bill talks about the department's comprehensive review of long-term care facilities that will be coming to us in spring. And then finally, the bill lists kind of a laundry list of areas that we'd like to stabilize or substantially support in the whole realm of services to seniors. And I'm not going to try to detail all of them. It ranges from Oregon Project Independence through some volunteer programs like RSVP and Senior Companions to looking at some of the general assistance issues, a variety of things that are needed to stabilize the exemplary long-term care system that we have in Oregon, but that we see crumbling around the edges as people like me move into that next generation, and the demographics are just really dramatic in the growth of that population that we will see. And I guess finally I would say that the as far as the bill itself is concerned, is that the financial driver behind this is that if those placements are moved to nursing homes, the sort of round figure that we've been working with is for every 100 nursing home placements, it costs the state $5 million a year. So economically, it makes a great deal more sense to place people in appropriate levels of care and at reduced rates from that, if possible. Now, there are a few questions that have come up along the way, and that's the substance of the bill that's moving forward as drafted at this point.
Representative, I have a question for you. Yes. So this bill, since it's starting on the Senate side, will it go then to Ways and Means, or will we have a chance to vet it in our committee?
I believe that it will come back to our committee at some point in time, but I'm not totally clear of the process. I think part of that is dependent on the amendments that I'm about to talk about.
Great. Go ahead.
In its substance as it is, we believe that the rate increase can be accommodated within the department's rebalance. And I'll let James go ahead and come forward here, and he can nod his head at me or shake his head if I'm saying something incorrect, because I do have a piece I'd like him to address.
Great.
Thank you. And but there are three issues primarily that have come up so far. And one of them is a desire to sort of move the Oregon Project Independence piece forward and to put a little bit more into that in the 08 session rather than waiting until 09 to look at that. So that would be a cost that would take this bill to Ways and Means. Secondly, there have been concerns raised because at this point it talks about rates for adult foster care, but not relative foster care, which is just one individual. And so if there's a desire to add relative foster care, there would be another cost impact. And thirdly, a question as to whether or not to also put a rate increase into the developmental disabilities world, DD, because after I say it once, I can use the letters, right? Because my tongue isn't working this morning. For foster care in that world, and there's an additional cost to that. So the desire has been to keep the bill relatively intact in its original format. If you remember, we brought together a large number of the primary advocate groups for seniors and people with physical disabilities and kind of worked through all of the needs and prioritized the list, and that's where this bill came from. And so the desire has been to keep the essence of it essentially intact. And then if we want to talk about these other issues, to put them as sort of separate packages that could be addressed separately in ways and means. There has also been some question raised by legislative counsel about access, fairness, and whether focusing our attentions on this particular population of the public-private market for seniors and people with physical disabilities has some connection to the Olmstead decision about that. Essentially, as this non-lawyer here understands it, is that you can't deny access to one population if you're providing access to another. My belief is strongly that we're not in any way denying access, but rather trying to preserve an access that we are losing for a specific piece of the population. And so that's what I would like to see if Mr. Taves from Department of Human Services has any more to add to that particular issue, but that's kind of where I see it at this particular point.
Great. It sounds like you've done a lot of work on this, Representative.
There's been a great deal of effort put into it. I've worked very closely with not only our subcommittee, but also Senator Morissette and the Senate Committee on Seniors and People with Disabilities. Because it's been sort of a group effort, and the Senate side had a specific committee for this issue and was open to a bill, that's the reason that it's going to be started through the Senate committee on the issue. But I will be there to make sure that it's closely watched as it moves through that side of the process as well.
Trust you to do that, Representative. Mr. Taves, wish to add to any of that.
Madam Chair, James Taves, for the record, James Taves from the Department of Human Services, the Senior and Disabilities Program.
James, just a second. I'm going to gavel in the full committee. Welcome, everybody who was late.
She's so
not
subtle.
Naming names, yes. And I forgot to mention, please turn off all your cell phones and Blackberries and Blueberries and Raspberries. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Callan, to address your questions, the first question is, yes, at this point in time, the $9.7 million figure in our rebalance plan is still there to do a rate increase across the board for assisted living, residential care facilities, and adult foster care for seniors and people with physical disabilities primarily. And again, the reason is our community capacity is declining very rapidly, and our nursing home counts are up almost by 500 people from where the caseload forecast would have been about 3 years ago. And at almost 6,000 a month per person on the nursing home side, that's a big swing in our budget. And if that caseload really expands, it's going to create some real budgetary problems for the department, and as well as the whole issue of people with seniors and people with disabilities want to live in community settings and not in nursing homes unless they absolutely have to. And that's what Oregon has been noted for, and so that trend to us is very critical. And on the community-based side, we just have almost a precipitous drop of people dropping out of the Medicaid market because the private pay market is expanding expanding so quickly. So at this point in time, it's in our rebalance plan. There were questions in the Ways and Means Committee last week about the assisted living portion of that and whether that rate increase would really bring the assisted living industry back in, and we're having some negotiations with that part of the industry now and trying to come up with a plan that will assure folks that, yes, in fact, we can increase access significantly on the assisted living side. So that's a kind of a remaining question in the rebalance plan that we're working on right now. To the second question, whether rate increases for one particular population disadvantages another and therefore creates ADA or Olmstead or other claims, again, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't answer that from a legal perspective, but we make rate changes all the time in all of our different systems, constantly, and to suggest that anytime you make a rate increase in one place, you have to replicate it everywhere else, or you have an ADA issue, it just doesn't make sense, and it's never, the way we've operated. I think if, in fact, our rate systems got so out of balance that access was significantly decreased for a particular population, I think there would be a real issue there, because under the Medicaid program, we have to provide access both for the numbers of people that are Medicaid eligible, geographic, and all of that. And certainly there could be a claim that if people were forced into institutional settings because community-based settings were not available because the state didn't pay adequate rates, I think there could be claims. But to suggest that anytime we make a rate change that that opens up that door, I think is a bit far-reaching. For example, last session we did nearly a $50 million total fund rate increase for developmental disability residential providers that was long overdue. Nobody claimed that opened up ADA or Olmstead claims for other populations. So, and I've worked with Medicaid directors all across the country. I've never seen rate changes for in these systems that automatically translate into those kind of claims. I just don't think it's an issue.
Thank you. And I would just reiterate that what we're trying to do here is preserve access.
But, Madam Chair, Representative Callan, in fairness to all the groups, there are lots of rate inequities in our system, and we've certainly heard it, and I don't want to disparage for one minute other groups that are saying we should be included as well. Again, the department in its rebalance plan was not primarily addressing rate issues or rate inequity issues across different parts of our system. We were dealing with a real severe and growing crisis in capacity in one part of our system that is pushing out into nursing home caseloads, which is the wrong policy direction, and it's obviously the wrong fiscal direction for where Oregon has been and where we want to go. So that really was the emergency that we were addressing in our rebalance plan, not the longer-term overall rate issues that we grapple with all the time.
Madam Chair, if I could just sort of wrap it up for you, that I think that's what's important, the fact that this little piece, this crisis that developed, makes it the emergent piece, because we have a number of facilities who are looking at contract renewals in January of 2009, and we're trying to influence some of that decision-making in those contract renewals. That's the reason for the broader scope of this particular bill, is that need to step back and to look at the complexities in our system all across the board, and this one happens to focus on the elderly population, but to try to do what it raises bigger questions of what the state of Oregon needs to address in terms of providing cost avoidance upfront, appropriate kinds of care and intervention to forestall more expensive options down the road. And that's the whole goal in this population, and I think it just begs the question that there is that question in other places as well.
Thank you, Representative Callan. Any questions? Yes, Representative Kotak.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. A question for Representative Callan. Thank you for all your hard work on this. I just wanted to get a clarification on the timelines.
Sure.
In terms of the comprehensive plan and the report back to the legislature that's referenced in Section 3 on page 3. I think you said the spring. I'm trying to remember from that initial presentation we had way back when.
I'm trying to remember. I believe it's April or May. Is there a particular line that that...
Well, because there's two things. There's the comprehensive plan, and then there's the report around cost projections that the legislature would get. I wouldn't mind seeing some clarification that that will happen early in the session on the cost projections versus... Because knowing how the budget process works,
right.
If we're going to wait till the session starts, maybe January versus March or April, so we can have some of those numbers out front earlier. I just didn't know if there was a specific timeline.
I'm not finding the specific reference in the bill now, but we're looking at, let me think where I am here. Correct me if I'm wrong, or I'll refer the question to you, but aren't we looking at the comprehensive plan coming out sometime in 2008?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek and Representative Cowan, the first or the next draft of the long-range plan based on a budget note from the last session, which in part is codified in this bill draft, is due this coming June of 08, to be presented to the emergency board. I think the other issues that Representative Kotek is referencing, where we're to do cost projections on a series of things, we anticipate that we would bring that in early in the session or even before the session if people wanted those numbers. In fact, a lot of those numbers have already been crunched based on past requests. I think people, and particularly the stakeholders, wanted those numbers sort of showing up independent of our budget cycle, so they and you all could make decisions independent of what we may recommend, I think was the intent. We will have those numbers ready pretty early on.
That is the intent, to it's a little bit separate from, I was looking for the exact date of the long-range plan kind of proposal. But the third component that looks at kind of this laundry list are not all aimed at the Department of Human Services budget. They are looking for some idea of how we can improve and stabilize the system and at what cost, and then we can do some good thinking around building that into some in the 09 and some beyond. I don't look at this as a single session issue, but rather to look at what we need to do in the system, what it might cost, and how can we prioritize that and develop it as we go along. So there aren't hard and fast timelines on, at this date we will add everything that's on this list.
No, thank you. I think it sounds like getting the information earlier, I think, would be really helpful. So, no, this is great. I think your list is very comprehensive, and I'd like to see the OPI portion. It's on page 3 where it talks about stabilization and provision of adequate funding for OPI. That, I assume, will stay in there, even if, for example, we might add additional dollars in 08. I wouldn't want that to come off the long-range plan.
It won't come off the long-range plan. I think that it's important to understand that nothing that we hope to do in 08 is looked at a long-term fix for the system, but perhaps just a Band-Aid here and there. And that's an important component, because one of my concerns is that sometimes when we get caught up in extensive discussions about one piece of the system or one particular service delivery, if we get something added to that, then it's easy to step back and say, okay, we fixed the long-term care system. Mm-hmm. So the whole goal of this bill is to look at it comprehensively and understand that assistance to stay in one's home for particular parts of the population is important. But we have to remember that the aging process is progressive, as much as I'm trying to deny that at this particular moment. And it isn't a failure if an individual is not able to stay in their own home forever. There comes a point in time when the most rational decision may be to move to some level of additional care, and that's why we need to keep that appropriate level of care available to folks across the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, James. Thank you, Representative Cowan. Good luck in the bill. Okay, we're going to open up a public hearing and work session public hearing, right, on Legislative Concept 5.
Thank you, Chair. LC 5, which is in your packet, is a bill that came up last session. This is a little bit of a reworking of it. Basically, currently, health insurers in Oregon right now are not required to reimburse licensed professional counselors or licensed marriage and family therapists for services. This bill, in essence, adds those therapists to the required provider reimbursement list, basically, along with the other clinicians that are already on there. The bill would prohibit people from using the titles professional counselor, licensed marriage and family therapist, unless they were licensed, and then to not allow people to use the word counseling or counselors unless they meet certain exceptions, such as a student who's being supervised by a certain individual. That is basically it, Representative Tomei. And I believe Representative Buckley might be here to.
Terrific. Representative Buckley.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the Oregon House of Representatives. Thanks for your continued attention and support of this proposal. And before I mention anything else, I just have to say the respected vice chair's new goatee would fit him. He would fit in very nicely in Ashland. We'd hang out in the coffee shops together. So.
Madam Chair, I have to respond to that. Chin straps won't be effective.
Yeah, pretty well. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't wish to take a lot of the committee's time this morning, since this committee has heard the bill during last session and in the committee hearing in the fall when you agreed to move this forward. When there was continued discussion, I think Representative or Legislative Council has done a very good job drafting the bill, and we have, as per the Chair's request, made sure that everyone interested in this subject has received a copy of the draft. At this point, I have not heard back any concerns. We always keep our ears open for any concerns as we move forward with the bill. And I'd like to relate to the committee some very good news that I was informed of by one of the therapists who lives in my district, that Asante Health Systems in Jackson County has now added the therapists and counselors to their list of providers, as this bill would require insurance companies to do. So.
That's terrific. Good. Thank you, Representative. Any questions of Representative Buckley? All right. So now... All right, so this is still a public hearing, right? Okay. So we have Kristen Leonard, Gina Nickel, and...
Hello?
Kristen, go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, Kristen Leonard here representing the Oregon Coalition for Consumer Protection and Choice on Mental Health Care. And I just wanted to briefly, I don't want to spend a lot of time going into the nuts and bolts of this issue because I think you've all had lots of testimony over time, but just really wanted to thank you for your attention to this issue. We find it very important, and you will find that there are a lot of us quite passionate about this issue, trying to find a way to move forward in February, so we're excited about what you're doing, and just thank you for your work. And we want to make ourselves available to you for any questions you may have or additional information, data that you may need that we could possibly provide to you. So thank you.
Thank you, Kristen.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gina Nickel, Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and I want to say that our association is extremely behind this bill. We cannot tell you how long we've been waiting for this bill. This is very exciting. We do want to point out one addition that we put in the bill on page 6. To look at the issue of how we look at community mental health programs that are approved by the Department of Human Services. Not all qualified mental health professionals are licensed by this board. Some of them are in the process, but all of them have to be approved by the Department of Human Services. So we merely stuck in an exception for this section. And the reason we did that is because, as you know, in most of your communities, some of the community mental health programs are called counseling centers, and it would be very confusing to the public if they couldn't advertise their services as counseling services. This does not mean that somebody that is not licensed that works for a community mental health center can hang out their private shingle. That's not what it means at all, but we felt in order to protect the public community mental health programs, we needed to put in that section in the exemptions, and I'd be glad to talk to you about that further. But in the interest of moving this along, we're very supportive of the bill as it now reads.
Thank you. Any questions for Gina or Kristen? Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak on this issue? Great. So I'm going to close the public hearing and open up a work session on legislative concept 5. Before I do, I think there are a lot of there are people watching television. I always think of that when we work, that there's going to be an audience that has no idea what we're talking about. So I'm just going to sort of briefly, I think Representative Buckley summarized it, but I will say briefly that this is an issue, obviously, we heard about for many, many hours during our 07 session. We heard from the people who felt somewhat discriminated against it as licensed counselors and family therapists. They were not able to get health insurance. No, they were not. Their services were not covered by some of the health insurance companies. So that seemed like a disservice to them. The other issue is that many people were calling themselves and billing themselves, publicizing themselves as therapists and counselors when they did not have a license. So we wanted to cover those two issues. And I think this bill does it well. And I think we've talked, or I've not, but Representative Buckley and other people who are interested in this issue have worked with all of the stakeholders, and I think have come up with a bill that is good and that I think we can all support. So thank you for the stakeholders here who I know have put many, many hours into this, and we really appreciate it. So,
Madam Chair, I move that LC5 be recommended for introduction into the February 2008 special session.
Representative Olson moves that LC5 be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 session. Any discussion? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
William.
Well, first I wanted to say the folks that might tune in on television aren't the only ones that occasionally don't know what's going on, even when I'm here. But I am tuned into this one. And I also wanted to put a semi-urgent plea out to anyone in our audience today for a 1.5 or 1.75 pair of reader glasses. In addition to not having a cold, I don't have my glasses. So I can't read any of my notes. I just want to say about this, I've been interested in the testimony, as you referred to in the last session. I think it's an important issue. I have mentioned that I have a great deal of respect for this profession, and many have urged me to avail myself of it again, but I feel this is not a priority. I don't understand how this committee, after hearing testimony on a number of important issues, including the one that we discussed a minute ago, can say this is a priority for, let's be very careful here, I don't want to be incendiary, for a supplemental session that we are now facing. So I don't understand how this bubbled up to the top of the list, as important as it may or may not be. Secondly, the bill says requirement. I would say mandate. You know, you say requirement, I say mandate. Let's call the whole thing off. I don't know what the answer is to the question, why is this not a mandate? I don't believe that this is earth-shaking in its eventual costs. But as I have expressed before and others have expressed, our approach to proving health care in this building is so fragmented. And these kinds of mandates happen in all the different committees, and it all sounds good when we discuss it. But what is the cumulative effect on insurance providers and costs that they're going to incur, because they will incur costs under this bill, and pass those on eventually to the consumer. And so I think healthcare costs go up. This is not the most most earth-shaking mandate that I've witnessed in this building, but I think it's significant. And for that reason alone, I am reticent on this bill, and again, express my dissension on it being a priority bill for this committee.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gilley. Any other statements? All right. Clerk calls the roll, right?
Yes. Representative Cowan.
Yes.
Representative Gilliam.
No.
Representative Protek.
Yes.
Representative Maurer.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Dawson.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson.
Yes.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the majority, this bill, or the legislative concept 5, passes this committee and goes on. Where does it go from here?
It'll be introduced in the February 08 session.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to have a public hearing now and close the work session on concept LC legislative concept 5. Open up a public hearing on legislative concept 87. Oh, please, sure. Representative Gelser.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Representative Sarah Gelser from House District 16 in Corvallis and Philomath, and I wanted to talk with you a little bit today about legislative concept 87, where it came from, who's been involved in developing it, recognizing legislative council for making 3 drafts of this in the last 6 days, which is pretty impressive, and hopefully to answer a few questions, and I know there's some other folks that would like to talk with you about this as well. So legislative concept 87 came about last fall. In late in 2007, the Oregonian ran a disturbing special report about the incidence of abuse and neglect within the developmental disability system. The newspaper reported that of more than 10,000 total allegations of abuse or neglect in this system since the year 2000, investigators had substantiated 4,648 of these claims. And those incidents involved 2,035 caregivers and 2,033 victims. Half of those victims suffered more than one instance of substantiated abuse. After this article ran, advocates, administrators, and others pointed to some pretty significant challenges within our developmental disability system. County caseworkers attempt to manage overwhelming caseloads. That's a problem that's not addressed in this legislative concept, but something this legislature should address in the future. There is limited funding for monitoring at the state level for our residential services. Residential providers struggle with substandard reimbursement rates from the state, and as a result, have few resources for recruitment and training. Turnover of employees stands at about 75% each year. And although the increase in provider wages given in the last legislative session will help, it will not go far enough to address the serious deficiencies in the system due to years of budget cuts and neglect of technical assistance, training, and quality assurance. Currently, there is also no mechanism for the public, family members, case managers, or even employers to seek information about individuals in the system who chronically re-abuse their clients. Clients and families have no easy way to access information about the history of substantiated abuse and neglect reports for the facilities in which they or their loved ones live. There are no requirements to notify clients and others when there are substantiated cases of abuse, even though the monitoring requirement, because of the way we're structured, often rests with those case managers and family members who are closest to these individuals. The fines and civil penalties levied when there are substantiated cases of abuse are also limited because our statute is outdated when it comes to the levels of fines and civil penalties that the department is able to charge. And although case managers have tremendous responsibility for monitoring the safety and well-being of their clients, they have little information with which to determine where to keep the most watchful eye. Another important and related issue is that while employers may do criminal background checks before they hire folks, many of these cases of abuse will never be prosecuted in the criminal justice system and therefore won't show up on a criminal background check. The victims in these cases, literally and figuratively, have no voice in the justice system because their disabilities make them very poor witnesses. And in the cases of financial abuse, what might be their life savings would not amount to the level of a county district attorney's priority for prosecuting a theft. A great example of this actually comes from the senior system in my district. We had an individual who worked in a nursing home. He confessed to sexually assaulting two of his coworkers and raping three elderly women with dementia. He was convicted and sentenced to 99 years without the possibility of parole. However, upon appeal, the convictions on the three rape allegations against the elderly women with dementia were overturned because in the state of Oregon, you cannot have a conviction based on a confession when you don't have the corroborating testimony of your victims. And because these women did have dementia, they were not able to speak about this even though they confessed. And I think this is a great example of the problems of this population being able to access the criminal justice system. Many of the things we read about in the Oregonian are in fact crimes. Rape is a crime. Physical assault is a crime. We need to find a way to prosecute those things as crimes when they happen. In the February session, of course, we are limited in the scope of actions we can take to address the myriad problems within the system. I just highlighted a few. And I want to be clear that Legislative Concept 87 does not pretend to address the profound failures of the foundation of our system to care for adults with developmental disabilities. It does not address inadequate provider wages. It does not address inadequate funding of monitoring and technical assistance or requirements and resources for training and recruitment. But what it does is to provide a fix for the worst case scenario, the places where we know abuse has already occurred, and it will give us some of the tools to help everyone in the system prevent re-abuse from happening. It will also give the department tools to hold providers accountable when individuals are harmed due to substantiated abuse or neglect. So I want to give you a quick high-level summary of the bill, and you'll see it on the sheet that you have there. The bill, most of the bill applies only to the system of services for adults with developmental disabilities. These would be foster homes for adults with developmental disabilities, group homes, residential homes, the Eastern Oregon Training Center. It does not, in this first section, cross over into the seniors and people with physical disabilities. And I'll tell you when we switch in the bill to the thing that covers everybody. So in the DD system only, this bill would require the Department of Human Services to develop and maintain an online database of substantiated allegations of abuse within the adult developmental disability system. The database would be searchable by first and last name of the alleged perpetrator, by the name of the facility, and the owner of the facility. The database would simply have information that is already public information. I could call the department today and ask if Jane Doe has an allegation of abuse substantiated against her in the developmental disability system. At this point, the department has to take the time to manually sort through that and answer my question. This would simply make information that is already part of the public record, that already belongs to the public domain, more easily accessible to the people that need to use it. It's not any new information that we are putting out there. It is only the substantiated allegations of abuse that would go into this database. It's important to note also that there is no requirement in the bill. We're not requiring employers or anyone else to use the database. It is a tool that is available to the general public. So it is not a registry. It is not a list of people that are banned from working in the DD system. And this piece is important because there are a lot of reasons and a lot of levels of abuse allegations that are substantiated. And I can give you two good examples. In the area of financial abuse, there is a significant difference, for example, between a substantiated allegation of financial abuse because a provider allowed their client to purchase a soda for them on Christmas Eve, because the individual thought that would be a gift. And that would be substantiated likely as financial abuse. That wouldn't be consistent with, you know, appropriate relationships. However, that's very different than if an individual took someone's Social Security check and deposited it in their account. Another difference would be someone that comes and intentionally slugs someone in the stomach when they're frustrated with an inappropriate behavior, or someone that initiates CPR and initiates that in the wrong way and the individual is injured. Although both of those things might result in an injury and both of those things might be substantiated as abuse, the circumstances of those two things are very different. However, for consumers, case managers, guardians, it's important to have access to that information. Take the CPR instance. For example, if your loved one is someone that frequently requires CPR, you might want to know if that's a problem in the facility that your individual is living in. And you also want to know if there are consistent allegations of financial impropriety within a facility, even if they are minor infractions. So the database is not limiting. It just provides information that is already publicly available. The bill would require that all clients, guardians, and case managers would be informed about how to access this database by August 1st of this year. And they would also be informed about the database and how to access it each time the resident enters a new facility and each year at the case planning meetings. The bill also requires that clients and... The bill also requires that clients, guardians, and case managers need to be informed whenever there's a new residential placement and at the annual care plan meeting about how to make allegations of suspected abuse or neglect. And that's one of the things that we can improve in the system is the reporting and helping people understand how to enter into that system. Another very important piece of this bill is that it requires that facilities will immediately notify all clients along with their guardians and case managers each time there is a substantiated allegation of abuse or neglect within that client's individual home. And again, this is very important for those folks that are closest to these situations to be able to have their eyes on the safety of their loved ones in that area. The one requirement that this bill does put upon employers is that individuals applying to work within a residential facility would now be asked on their initial application whether they have ever had an allegation of abuse or neglect substantiated against them within the developmental disability system. In the original discussion of this bill, one of the issues that was raised was allowing the department to have the ability to take trusteeship over a facility which was really struggling, having a hard time, and the residents weren't safe. This ability already exists on the senior and physical disability side. And through the course of this discussion, we were able to determine that the department does already have that authority on the developmental disability side, so it did not need to be addressed in the bill.
Representative, I'm going to stop you for a minute. I'm just hearing so much, and my brain is just going so quickly. So I'm going to allow questions as we go along if other people generate questions as they're hearing this. So one of the things, I was somewhat confused. So you're saying if at Christmas time the client says to a nurse, take $2 out of my wallet and buy yourself a Coke for Christmas. Are you saying that that would have to be noted as, what did you call it, financial abuse?
Thank you, Chair Tomei. If the definition of abuse of a person with a developmental disability is pretty broad because it's a very, very vulnerable population, what would go into the database are the substantiated allegations of abuse. One of the reasons why we want the facilities to make the notification when an allegation happens is that there's always going to be more information about that allegation. So both people that might later look on a database when they're doing hiring or they're right now calling to ask about that information, they would probably look at that very differently than, you know, stealing somebody's Social Security check. And the same as with a client.
I still don't know the answer to my question, which is, would that have to be in the database?
Yes, that would go. That all substantiated allegations of abuse would go into the database.
Okay, and that would be considered an abuse.
Under the yes, Madam Chair, under this, if it's substantiated, if the circumstances are substantiated, that is one of the types of circumstances that might be substantiated for abuse.
All right, thank you. Well, we're stopped.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question for the representative because I am not clear on the definition of abuse because I looked up the definition that is referenced for this section, or ORS 430.735. I had the impression it was only, and I don't want to contradict you, I just want to make sure. I didn't think financial abuse would be in here, and maybe I'm missing something. So, because this is mostly the definition of abuse that's referenced is death, physical injury, willful infliction of physical pain, sexual harassment, neglect. I'm not saying that financial abuse isn't an issue. I'm just not seeing it here. So
All right, that's a good question.
Lori, would you come up, please? This might take a little bit of time because there have been some changes in this concept. We might take time to answer these questions and make sure that we fully understand it. Thank you, Lori.
Thanks, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Lori Freeman, Office of Legislative Counsel. The definition of abuse comes out of there's a special section on abuse that occurs of people who have developmental disabilities and mental illness, and that's where the definitions comes from. And it's broad enough that it gives the department discretion to define what abuse is. And so whatever is within those parameters, maybe James Taves would want to have to come up. I'm not sure what the Oregon administrative rules, how they define abuse, but it could fall within those parameters.
James?
Madam Chair, James Taves from the Department of Human Services. The department had abuse rules that predated even this particular statute under kind of our federal Medicaid authority, and it was a very expansive definition of abuse. When this particular statute was enacted in the early to mid-90s, I think it was 93, there was a long discussion about whether we would then shrink the abuse definition just to meet the statutory definition or whether we would continue as we had previously, having a broader definition, because again, it's such a vulnerable population. At the time, we were also in the middle of closing Fairview. It was a very volatile issue. We did a lot of work with our stakeholders, and we chose to keep in our administrative rules a much more robust definition of abuse than what is actually in statute. So yes, indeed, our definitions exceed the statutory definition.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair. Representative Gelser, trying to get a handle on this a little bit for the abuse side. And as you were describing at the very beginning, for the substantial allegations, how many of those do you consider, or do you consider them all, that they would be subject to prosecution then? I mean, I'm trying to get to where you're at with this, because I'm thinking if it's abuse, and just like what, you know, the chair had asked you the question about taking $2, and if you got a criminal act involved in that for culpable mental state, why aren't we doing something with prosecution?
Thank you, Vice Chair Olson and Chair Tomei, for that question. We have a real problem in our criminal justice system in that this population of people does not have the ability to enter it. I have been meeting with some of the providers about this bill, and we've talked about broader issues as a result, and the issue of the ability to prosecute these crimes is one that has come up again and again and again. These people don't have very much money, and if you're looking at financial abuse, for instance, and you've got a county that is struggling with their own district attorney budget, their prosecution budget, and they're prioritizing which crimes they're going to prosecute, the theft of, you know, $10 is not going to rise very high on their list of priorities to prosecute, even if the impact of that theft for this particular individual, given how impoverished they are, is really much greater than you would anticipate from that $10. And, you know, the same is true around physical abuse, around sexual abuse. It is simply very, very difficult in a court of law to get to that standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, because the victims, as witnesses, are individuals with developmental disabilities that have a very difficult time being sworn as witnesses and testifying on the stand credibly due to their cognitive disabilities. And I think that, again, that's one of the reasons why this population is so vulnerable and why you would have a fairly broad definition of abuse. I wish that we could do more, and I'm actually working with my local district attorney on some ideas for 2009 about how we could make some more entry points into the system for folks with developmental disabilities, including for those cases that do get there. For example, a financial abuse where there's a theft might show up as a misdemeanor. And when you run a criminal background check, you might look at that and think, well, it was a youthful indiscretion, it was shoplifting, when in fact it was maybe taking someone's Social Security check. So our local district attorney had suggested if we create a you know, a category like assault, domestic violence, if we had theft, elderly, disabled, that kind of popped up on the criminal history check, so we have a little bit more ability to see what's happening criminally.
So if I could just jump in here, if I may. So what I'm hearing is that it's really difficult to prosecute these issues, and that's why it's so important to have this registry, because it may not rise to the level of being prosecuted, but it should be. It should be on this registry so that people can see that information. Is that, am I correct?
Yeah, it should be on the database so that people have access to the information. I look at this, at the database piece, really as a consumer protection kind of piece of information. We've had some conversations about, does it make sense for everything to go into the database since there is a very broad definition of abuse? But when you start trying to sort out what do you put in and what do you keep out, it's hard to know for any individual client or family what's going to be significant or not significant to them. Right now, all of this information is public record. We need to trust case managers and families to handle information and make decisions about safe placements for their individuals and to be able to understand what's happening in there. And we can't protect people by keeping information from them.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I can just follow up where you were going originally with the conversation between individual in the home as well as, and then the employee asking, well, you know, somebody says, you know, $2, take $2, you know, buy yourself a Coke, you've done an outstanding job. How does that turn into abuse? I guess I'm not getting that, or maybe I wasn't listening well with that, but I don't get that part for being a substantiated abuse.
Sure, thank you for the question. I think the place that it could be a violation of procedure, it could be a violation of rule. If you are an individual that is hired to provide direct care for a person with a significant cognitive disability that is relying upon you for almost all of their needs, do they really have the ability, you know, to make a free will decision?
Can I stop you there for a moment? So you're dependent on the agency's policy as well for determining what the abuse would be?
The way that an allegation of abuse is substantiated, it goes through the department's process, and those are the allegations that we would be talking about. Somebody makes a complaint of abuse, an investigation happens, people are interviewed, and when there is evidence to support that abuse took place, that is the point at which it becomes a substantiated allegation. So these are the investigations of abuse that happen within the Department of Human Services through their monitoring and protective services.
So if I can play with that a little bit.
Sure.
So what I'm hearing is that the agency may say, you may not take anything from a client.
That's policy.
Right.
Exactly.
That's policy.
Yes.
Right. So somebody says, but I saw this client give Sally $2 for a Coke. Well, she said that I could. Well, you're not supposed to do that, so we're going to write that up. Would that be a correct assessment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would. And the reason that I raised that issue, that is, frankly, for me, not the reason why I'm bringing you this bill. My concern is more where there is willful infliction of harm and pain or theft of Social Security checks, things that are on a much greater level. The reason that I raised the issue is I think that it's very important to acknowledge that when you see numbers here, like 4,648 incidents of abuse, some of those are on this smaller scale, and some of those would be within this database. I don't think that there's a good way to go through and weed out which ones go in and go out. And I think there's a lot of questions around self-advocacy and self-determination about whether you should be able to purchase a gift for someone that you care about. And that I'm afraid that I've taken us off on a tangent. I just wanted you to be aware that those types of allegations would be in here. The impetus for this is the more egregious violations, which really put these individuals at physical risk.
Sure. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. On back to my previous question about definition of abuse, and I don't know how we deal with this, but I do think there has to be clarification somewhere that there is a more expansive definition out there, because the way this reads to me, if I go look up the ORS, there is more out there, but it doesn't seem to tie back to anything. So I don't know if we can clarify that somehow.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I think we will clarify that in implementing House Bill 2175, which passed this last session, which requires the department to create an abuse registry which in turn then will be used for screening for employment purposes. And that goes way beyond creating a database. That's where we will actually require, and it will be almost like the criminal record check. You'll also have to check an abuse registry. Obviously, given all the case law in employment, the threshold in terms of the type of abuse, what we now call abuse, and we may even change the definitions of abuse and say these things are care practices or maltreatment or violate policy, and abuse in and of itself is only a much higher threshold for people that really have created or done willful assaults and sexual assaults and neglect and that type of thing. Because, again, when we use any of this information for employment purposes, people have a due process right. They have the right to a full contested case hearing. States that have created registries have to go that extra step. So I think we will clarify that. And that also then applies to all the population served by the department. So that includes developmental disabilities, seniors, because, again, some of these workers can jump from one field or type of service to another. And, again, here we're only working on the developmental disability side. So I believe we will, I was going to say clean that up, but I believe we will tighten definitions because they'll be used for different purposes, namely employment then, but we still want to make sure that we have an expansive list of things that are reported, investigated, because as we've just talked about here, even what appear to be small incidents can be pretty significant in the life of a very vulnerable person.
Follow up? Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That's helpful. I'm fully supportive of the searchable database. I think it's important. Inherent in doing one of those databases is making sure the right stuff shows up there, because once someone searches, you want to make sure that the information is accurate. I wanted to hear a little bit more from the department about how you substantiate complaints. Is there any kind of appeal process for the provider? I'm just, by the time, what's the process at which point the information then ends up on the database? I'd like to know a little bit of the back process, if that makes sense. How do you take an allegation to a substantiation, which then would put in the database?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, the threshold is pretty low. Essentially, we, to substantiate a case, we investigate, first of all. Investigations are conducted either at the county level by county staff, or if it's a very high-profile case, we have a centralized unit in the department that takes over high-profile investigations, but also then reviews all the reports that come in from local government, the local case managers as well. Substantiation essentially is reason to believe. So even it's not absolute proof. In the legal standard, I don't even know if it's preponderance or clear and convincing, but if we have enough evidence to believe that it actually happened, even if we couldn't prove it in a contested case hearing or a court of law, we still substantiate that case. It's almost erring on the side of the client as opposed to the employee, which, again, is an important distinction if we end up using this for employment purposes, because then the threshold and the evidentiary threshold is going to have to go way up. But at this point, we substantiate based on reason to believe that it happened and enough evidence there to suggest, more than suggest, but cause us to believe that it really did happen.
Follow up. This will be my last one. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm familiar with the percentages in Child Protective Services about complaints made, substantiated. You get X number of complaints. Some of them are substantiated. What's your rate of substantiation from investigation? I'm just curious.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, it's about 40%.
Okay.
It's about 40%. And, again, this is a delicate area because states that have gone to registries who then use it for employment purposes and significantly raise the evidentiary threshold, mm-hmm. the rate of substantiation goes way down. Mm-hmm. So it's there's pros and cons.
Thank you, because that's very similar to there is, about half of the complaints that you might find the child welfare system won't be. That's why you investigate. They're not all accurate. So thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of moving this bill along and focusing on some of the issues, particularly the physical abuse, my question, I guess, is to anyone on the panel. Would it be possible in the bill to refer to the statutory definition that Representative Kotek referred to, not excluding financial abuse, but veering away from it in order to move the bill along, and secondly, allow the kind of change in or tightening up of the definition that's going to come from other legislation.
I mean, I suppose that, thank you, Representative Gilliam, Chair Kotek, Chair Tomei.
You just promoted.
It's my Heather Committee. I think that anything is possible. I really would hesitate to see a move away from having the ability to search on that financial abuse issue. If you read the Oregonian article, that is a really good reason why financial abuse should be included in this. Here was a case where you had an individual that was working in a facility that was substantiated multiple times for financial mistreatment of clients in that home. Everything from stealing Social Security checks to pocketing money that was sent as a memorial for a deceased resident of the facility to purchase a barbecue for everybody else. And when that article ran, the other families that had individuals that in that home didn't know that these problems existed. They should have had that information so that they could have stopped doing things like send money to their loved ones or send memorials. So I think that type of information is very important because this population is very vulnerable to financial abuse. And again, it's important to remember that this is not a registry. It is a database. And to keep in mind who it is that's going to be using it, when it would be used, and what the information is. The information is already publicly available. The information is most likely to be used by individuals that are concerned about something that's happening in their loved one's home or their client's home, and it's likely to be used, you know, at the time of notification or when there's been an incident in a facility. The Oregonian actually has a database like this up and running. They've been running it since last fall. They haven't had any complaints about it thus far. And I know families and others that have used it. They've searched it because they were concerned when they read the article. And while some places it will provide information, in other places it's going to provide some significant peace of mind to people who are there. So I really see this as an important consumer protection piece. I think there's important questions around this, but it's certainly not like a sex offender registry where you're going to type in my zip code is 97330, how many people in my 5-mile vicinity have been substantiated for an allegation of abuse or neglect. The audience of people who are going to be interested in this is extremely small, and quite frankly, these are people that should have access to the information.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Let you proceed in your
great
presentation.
Thank you. I think I already mentioned the trusteeship of the facilities that DD has that ability. So this next section of the bill is SPD-wide. This has to do with the fines and civil penalties. And this would impact seniors, people with physical disabilities, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, adult foster care, kind of across the board. So the current schedule of fines and civil penalties has not been revisited in a very long time, and it is quite out of date. For this section of the bill, the department would have the authority to determine the fine and civil penalty schedule. We had a lot of discussion about this, and a lot of discussion about this with the stakeholders. And one of the reasons we wanted the department to have the flexibility to set these levels is so that they can respond to the difference in the severity of an allegation. We don't want to put a minimum civil penalty fine in statute, again, going back to the financial abuse for a substantiated claim, and have the same minimum fine for the soda incident as you do for the barbecue incident. With the exception of this, in certain cases, we did come to the agreement that there should be a statutory minimum fine for serious offenses. So in the cases where a violation resulted in the death, serious injury, rape, sexual abuse, or sexual exploitation of a client, there would be a statutory minimum. We're still having discussions about what that statutory minimum would be, and that's why there is a blank line in the bill, and that's a policy decision that this committee will have to make in February in terms of what number to put in that fine. My office is currently doing research on a variety of other kinds of civil penalties for different kinds of abuse and other civil violations so that we can kind of peg that appropriately. There's been a change even since yesterday's draft in the bill. As I mentioned, a lot of people have been working on this. Lori's been very patient with making lots of revisions, and I'm sure she's excited to hear about further amendments. in the draft that you have, the licensing fees would also be set by the department by rule, and there has been a discussion for quite some time about how and when and how much to increase licensing fees by, and I believe Lauren Rose is going to come up and testify later, but I believe that there is a, we're close to an agreement now between the department and the Oregon Healthcare Association about an increase in the licensing fees that people will agree to, and they would like to go ahead and have that in statute, and everyone at this point is very agreeable to doing that. One of the things that makes this agreeable is the creation here of a quality care fund. Right now, licensing fees, civil penalties, and fines all go into the DHS general fund. This bill would create the quality care fund, which would be limited to expenditures that would improve the quality of care in these facilities through activities such as monitoring, training, and technical assistance to the facilities. And I know that the stakeholders in the process have an interest in seeing that, you know, civil penalties and fines from the DD side are used for DD improvements, and those that are collected on the senior and physical disability side are used for improvements on that side. But that's one of the things that I really like about this proposed bill, is that it's not just a punitive thing where we're going to go in and increase fines when things happen. We're actually going to turn those fines around and use them for that purpose, to improve care and to provide some assistance. And I think it could provide a good step forward in increasing our attention on these particular on these issues. I had a couple more things I wanted to say. So I wanted to underscore again, LC 87 is very limited in what it does. We have many, many, many problems in our developmental disability system, and I think, as we're all aware on this committee, within our human service system, our human service system as a whole deserves a lot more attention than what we have given it, both with our time and our budget in recent years. And in terms of the DD system, I very much hope that the legislature will act in the next session to take more dramatic steps towards improving the quality of care, safety, and dignity of these most vulnerable individuals. I also wanted to acknowledge that this bill has been developed with the cooperation and collaboration of all stakeholders. Although everybody has a different interest in this, the employers, the employees, the clients, the advocates, and others, everyone kind of has an overarching focus on the safety and well-being and dignity of the individuals that everybody strives to serve. And coming out of the DD system, I kind of take pride in that. I think that's something that's very unique in the system. A lot of times when you have articles like that that ran last November, all the finger pointing begins, and that's not what I saw happening here. I saw everybody coming together to say, okay, what can we do to continue to address these problems? So people involved in these discussions have included SEIU, the department has been extremely helpful, large providers, small providers, the Oregon Healthcare Association, and everyone has been willing to give a little bit on this issue and take some risks to move forward on the proposal that you have before us. I think the other thing that's important to remember is the reason it's important to do this in February is we've got folks that are in danger today. We have the ability to take this small step forward to improve safety for some of them. And while we talk about these things and recognize that there's some pretty awful things happening within the system, the number of good foster homes, good group homes, good facilities, and good providers and employees far outweigh the number of folks that we're trying to make sure don't have access. And I think it's always important to acknowledge the work of those that really are committed to the well-being of the folks that are there. So thank you very much. I'm glad to answer any other questions that you might have, and I do hope you'll introduce this bill. I very much hope that we can move it forward, because I do think that it will help to keep some folks safe, a good number of folks safe. A single case of abuse or neglect or sexual abuse is too many. We're above the 4,000 mark, and I think that's a cry to action quickly.
Thank you, Representative. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your discussions on the bill, you have this line we have to fill in around civil penalties, or penalty, I assume, to the provider if there's a particularly egregious abuse situation. Did you talk about when you lift someone's license, period? I mean, at what point does a facility have a track record of not either managing their employees or, you know, ensuring the safety of the folks that they're handling to pull their license? I'm just wondering if that came up at all.
Do you want
to, Madam Chair, Representative Kotek? Yes, we pull licenses, and we've done that in several pretty high profile cases in the last couple of years. I think the issue for us is having an expanded toolbox to deal with issues. Because often when we pull a license or we declare an immediate threat, then you have to shut the program down immediately. There is great risk when you move lots of vulnerable folks almost overnight and disperse them and break up their relationship with other staff, and it just creates a lot of risk. So our hope is that, A, we can do meaningful civil penalties that really will change behavior, because right now it is so nominal that you can include it in the cost of doing business, quite frankly. So that, I think, will give us more leverage. We are working, and we hope to propose legislation this next session that would give us a much more streamlined trusteeship process, where we can actually, because now it's quite a cumbersome process in going into court. It usually takes almost 10 days to get a hearing, and the conditions you're alleging are often life-threatening, so you ought to be going in that day, not waiting for a hearing 10 days later. So we want to try to look at an approach that would allow us to intervene almost immediately and bring in external management and actually run the program for a while we decide whether ultimately it needs to be shut down, but then we have transition time with clients and families and others. So what we're looking for is just a range of options that includes shutting a program down, but also having meaningful steps that precede the actual license revocation that can correct behavior or allow us to intervene much earlier.
Thank you. Very helpful.
One question, James. I just want to follow up on a question, a comment you just made. Should you choose or determine that you need to step in and to review what's going on there, are you going to need additional people to do that?
Madam Chair and Representative Olson, we actually added numbers of inspectors and monitors in the last budget cycle. I suspect we'll make recommendations again in the next budget cycle. We have statutory requirements for some facilities we license every year. In some, it's a two-year review process, but then for poor performers, we have to go in often quarterly because they have significant problems. So, yeah, I mean, we were stretched pretty thin in that, but we'll look at that as part of any package that we propose.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you so much. I know this was a team effort, and it took a lot of effort on, obviously, the three of you, and I know other people. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll call up Tracy, is it Rutan? Brian DeLashmut, and Don Aker. Catherine.
Yeah.
So you're wanting to come up with Catherine? All right. Sure, Tracy, go ahead.
Okay.
Did I pronounce your name correct, Tracy?
Close enough. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tracy Benton with the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. I don't want to take a lot of your time today. I just simply wanted to put on the record a situation that was brought to our attention several months ago, and maybe the potential for inserting language into LC 87 to add physical therapist and occupational therapist under the list of mandatory child abuse reporters. In November, Diana Godwin, who's legal counsel for the Oregon Physical Therapist in Private Practice, contacted me and relayed a situation of a physical therapist she works with who was informed by a patient of a situation of child abuse within that patient's foster care home. The concern that was brought to our attention was that in looking at the statutes more closely, Ms. Godwin was made aware that physical therapists are not listed as mandatory child abuse reporters currently. She wanted to, I think, provide some guidance to this physical therapist to say, by law, you've got to report this. Ultimately, in the end, the abuse was reported at the urging of the physical therapist. However, we would like to see that, you know, in the future, that there is more clarification in the law as to the responsibility of physical therapists to report those types of situations as they are brought to the attention of a physical therapist or also occupational therapist. And I've provided testimony, written testimony from Ms. Godwin that relays this situation, I think, in more detail. I didn't want to get into it too much today with you, as I know that you need to get out of here, I think, by noon. So, the situation is accounted in her testimony and also some written testimony from the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board, who has expressed interest
as well at being added onto the mandatory list of reporters. You know, oftentimes physical therapists are working in situations with children in school settings, in home settings, and oftentimes I think would be an appropriate person to notice if there might be abuse or potential abuse occurring, or for a child who might relay some information to them that would make it appropriate for them to report that abuse to authorities. So I appreciate your time and consideration. If you could think of adding any language in at any point during February, we'd appreciate that consideration.
Thank you, Tracy. Any quick questions? Thank you. Now we'll have Brian Zalashmet, David Baker, and Catherine White.
You want to start? For the record, I'm Brian Leishman. I'm here representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. With me is Donald Aker, who is from one of the member organizations of that group. This organization provides residential care for developmentally disabled clients, among some other services. And so I just wanted to give you the background of why we have an interest in this. Let me first start out by thanking Representative Gelser for including us in the discussions. There has been a whirlwind of discussions over this bill and the four drafts. The last draft that we saw was at 4:31 yesterday afternoon as I was finally shutting my computer off. I tried to review it this morning. And so if you'll give me a little indulgence, this is my notes on that. So I'm going to try and go through my notations. Some of these issues are issues that I've already addressed with Representative Gelser. Some have been checked in. Some of them are issues that we're going to continue to raise to help make this a better bill. And I wanted to make sure that everybody understands our goal here today is not to oppose this bill, not to scuttle this bill, but to make this a much better bill by the time we get out of here in February. With that said, let me start through my notations here. As was said earlier, any abuse is unacceptable. We find it unacceptable as provider group. We want to make sure that these people have a safe and loving environment. And that's our ultimate goal in this, is to make this bill better and make sure that that in fact occurs. With that said, one of the bigger issues for us in not only the drafting of this bill, but the bigger picture about ultimately making sure there's enough resources within the department and within the system that the training, the education, the retention of workers is taken care of. We want to make sure that if this particular bill is addressing the issue, not the bigger issue of whether the resources are there, because we've talked about that. We know there's additional needs for resources, not only for provider wages, for the facilities, but also for the division to do investigations and so forth. So we'll set that aside. But in this particular bill, what we're attempting to look at and make sure that the focus is that, in fact, the focus is on the abuser. And in reading through this, we would continue to look at the new draft to make sure that the focus is on the abuser rather than on the facility that, in fact, may be a very good actor. They may, in fact, as soon as they realize something's gone on, investigate that internally themselves, report that, get it to the division, do all the appropriate steps. However, in this bill, the sanctions are against the facility. So we want to continue to look at that, and is there some way to deal with those facilities that, in fact, may have somebody who does some abuse, but they are good actors. And I kind of liken this almost like to, I'm a sports person, to the NCAA, a self-reporter of an NCAA violation versus an outside investigation. The second point that I would make is that graduated penalties. And you talked a little bit, and I'll talk a little bit about a soda incident in a minute. I don't want to divert us from the main goal of this. But one of the issues that we want to make sure that as we go through the rulemaking process with the division, that in fact there is graduated penalties, that it's not a standard penalty for a violation. The violation can be vastly different depending on what the violation is, the soda incident versus the stealing the Social Security checks. And so to have a standard penalty for a violation, we believe, and it's our understanding that as we go through this and develop these the penalties, so forth, with the division, that there'll be graduated penalties, not only for the level of the occurrence or the level of the offense, but also the number of occurrences. And we very strongly encourage that. let me divert just for a minute onto the soda incident. The incident that came to our attention, and Representative Gelser was at the meeting, was not that the individual client purchased a soda for the caregiver. It was that the caregiver was on a field trip with two clients, and they stopped, I believe, to get candy at a 7-Eleven and a soda or something, and the caregiver didn't have the resources with them. The one client had additional money, and the other one didn't have enough money. The second client wanted to get a Coke, but the caregiver knew that in her account back at the shop, there was additional resources for the second person. So the first person volunteered to buy the soda for the second person, and that was in fact investigated and substantiated as financial mismanagement or financial abuse. And the caregiver themselves documented what had occurred, went back, said, this is what occurred. It was the right thing to do at the time, but I understand it was a violation. That would in fact appear in the database. We want to make sure that we're really capturing true abuses rather than in this database, and even the investigation process, that we're focused on those things that are important versus these things that are in fact paperwork abuses. So that was the soda incident that we're talking about. Let's see. The next point is an issue that was raised by the provider groups, and we have had a discussion with Representative Gelser on this. There's some concern about liability exposure of the facilities in dealing with these cases of abuse. And as I understand it, and if you need additional clarification, that's why Donald is here. But it's my understanding that they have policies in place and the ability to hire and fire. If they fire somebody for what they believe internally is a violation of that policy and abuse, prior to turning that over to either DHS or the counties for investigation, they likely don't have exposure. But if they, in fact, do not fire that person prior to turning it over to an investigative agency, then they're put in the position of having to wait until it's substantiated or not substantiated. And if they take a personnel policy action against that individual during that time period, they in fact probably do open, at least according to the attorneys for the facilities, open themselves at some risk of exposure for wrongful termination, especially if it comes back as unsubstantiated at the end. So our concern was that we felt there needs to be some protection in here that encourages the employer to take the action that they feel is appropriate and still have some protection as far as their facility from the liability.
Representative Gelser?
Yes, may I ask a quick question?
Yes.
By way of clarification? So just to make sure that I understand correctly, there's nothing in this bill that exacerbates that problem. You're asking to have something added to the bill to help alleviate a problem that currently exists in the system.
Yeah, Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, that is correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is correct.
Can I interrupt here for a moment? Thanks. Brian, I just want some clarification from what I get from you right now with this bill. Should an abuse be reported, an incident occur, whose responsibility is it to investigate that then to determine whether or not it's substantiated or unsubstantiated, that being driven by policy for the employee or the employer or DHS?
Let me take a stab at this, and maybe Donald can pipe in as well. It's my understanding that internally the facilities do their own, I guess I wouldn't term it an investigation.
A personnel investigation.
But a personnel investigation, yeah. To say, yeah, so-and-so saw somebody else do this, and we need to take action upon that. Their responsibility, however, is to turn it over to DHS or to the counties to do an investigation of the abuse. So the investigations we're really talking about here are the investigations by DHS or the counties, or as written in this bill, and as I understand, in some cases when it's a pretty heinous crime, it could be law enforcement as well. If it's a rape case or an assault case. So you're really talking about two different things. You're talking about the internal review, employment review, and policy review versus the reporting of the abuse in itself.
So you're almost kind of talking like a parallel investigation going on.
Correct. Let's see if I can find it.
Representative Kotek has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So at what point in the process do you need protection? Once you say we know that something went on and we report it to DHS or the county, my understanding is it sounds like there's some gray area. What happens after that's reported? I wouldn't necessarily want to put protection. I mean, management should know what's going on to some degree. So I'm just curious, at what point do we need protection for the employer? I'm just trying to get a handle on that.
Representative Kotek, let me make it real clear. It's not protection for the employer as a result of the abuse. It's the protection about wrongful termination of the employee. So the employer is sure that this case has occurred. They've reported it. They believe, based upon some of their attorney's feedback, is that they have they're in the gray area as far as termination of that person until there's substantiation by the investigation. We're not talking about the internal investigation. We're talking about the investigation by DHS, law enforcement, or by the county. And to complicate that, and this is another point that we've actually talked to Representative Gelser about, and I think everybody agrees, is that in the cases where it's counties investigating, there is not equal treatment of these cases, either in the vigor in which they investigate or the level of things that they investigate, so that you also have situations where you may have, for example, Dungarvan or some of the other facilities that have multiple facilities in different counties. They're all treated differently, and they attempt to report them all the same, but how they deal with them in different counties complicates the system of not only, okay, what makes ultimately the registry, and I know we're not choosing the database, not the registry, but also how they deal with employment practices too. So our concern is that the counties, the state and the counties, we need to all be on the same page as far as what's reported, what's substantiated, how they're investigated, the vigor in which they're investigated.
Does that answer your question, Representative Kotek?
It does. I do get the wrongful termination angle here. But I wouldn't mind hearing from the department about the inconsistency across the state and how things are investigated, if that is true or not.
And I just want to remind us all that this is just the beginning process. We're going to have plenty of time to vet this during the session.
Well, maybe that could be something we can talk about when we come back. I don't need to have that answer today.
Right.
Good. Thank you.
I'm very close to being done on the draft itself, and it relates to the language of the draft versus some of my notes. If you look at the draft on page 2, section 2, line 5 and 6, they talked about establishing creating and maintaining a database. One of the issues that came up actually in reading this language this morning between a discussion between Donald and myself is that database going to include the past occurrences as well? If that's the case, then that complicates it as far as which counties do different investigations at an uneven level. So is the database, in fact, going to be accurate, a reflection of what's really going on out there? And we just raised that issue. And if it's intended to capture those in the back, everybody just needs to understand that, in fact, there may be some anomalies there in which the data is not going to be as accurate or as clear as data that's captured from this point forward, in which we have a very clear picture of how we're capturing stuff, how we're reporting that stuff.
And I think the intent of this meeting today is to raise as many questions as possible. They're going to be coming up during the February session. And so that's great. We're not going to get the answers today, but let's indeed raise the question.
Yeah. Same page, section 3, and this just came up again, additional discussions. And I did mention this to Representative Gelser before we started, so she's not surprised by this discussion. In Section 3, it requires a facility to provide the notice. So if something's occurred and it's substantiated, then there's a notice that occurs to the resident, the case managers, and the resident's guardians. And although we believe that there is a distinct advantage to that, in which the facility then has the ability to explain the circumstances of what happened, what actions they've taken. It's probably better than just getting a letter from DHS saying there was a violation in this facility. We actually like that way of going about it. The concern is that if you, in fact, have a bad-acting facility, is there any guarantees that, in fact, they'll report So you have a facility that has some violations. Is there going to be some monitoring or some language in here that has a set of checks that, in fact, this particular piece is occurring, rather than if you set it with DHS or with the county, in which they're reporting to the residents' garden, and so forth, then it would be uniform. So I think that's an issue that we can work a little bit more on, is to make sure that, in fact, when the requirement's there, there's going to be some way to check to make sure that, in fact, that piece is taken care of. I already mentioned about the counties as the designees on the investigations and what appears to be, at least for my folks, some inconsistencies on how different counties handle different things. That's contained in the first part of Section 5 when it talks about DHS or its designees, and then it goes down and talks about law enforcement there. And so we wanted to put on the record to make sure that it's our hope that we, in fact, have uniform not only in what's reported, but what's investigated, and the level of those types of investigations and substantiations that are then going to be contained in the database. With that, I'm sure there's going to be some things that I missed, and I will come back. I vow to you that I will continue to work with Representative Gelser based on my notes. And if you want a summary of some of the issues that I brought up, if you need it, I'll be happy to provide that to you as well.
Thank you, Brian.
For the record, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, and I do have some written testimony that I'll provide you. I think many of the comments that I wanted to make in testimony have already been made, so I want to respond to a couple of the questions that have been raised and some of the issues raised. Number one, we view this clearly as a first step, a very first step. The issue of consistency around counties, the issues of a common way of doing investigations, timelines, people who are doing these investigations, are all part of some discussions that have been occurring for several months. And we fully expect that we will come into the 2009 session with a package of proposals that will address some of these issues in terms of who's responsible, how do they conduct it, what's the training, etc. Because this is an issue that we have all been aware of for some time, and it really is now time to address that inconsistency. So I just want to say that, you know, we see this as a very first step. In regard to the database, and one of the things that we are very supportive of this database, simply because it makes things more transparent, it makes information more accessible, and it really puts out there the message that inappropriate behavior is just not acceptable in a culture of service. And I think what sometimes can happen is that we start ignoring little things and they suddenly become big things. And I think that this database is very important for beginning to get that information out there. And I want to just give you a personal example. And that is, When the Oregonian database came out, I immediately, of course, went to the database and started looking for the care providers of my son. And I found two instances of substantiated abuse by one of his absolutely best caregivers. Okay, somebody that does a wonderful job with my son, who my son adores. This information gave me, and no one had mentioned this to me before, this information gave me an opportunity to sit down with him and talk about these instances. They were abuse without harm. They were, you know, doing something that kind of fit into that category of, boy, that's a dumb move, but nobody got hurt. But it was an important opportunity to have that conversation, to sit down and really say to him, I'm watching, I'm aware, did you realize that was dumb? And it gave him an opportunity to say, yes, that was really, I recognized what I did, it's never happened again, it will never happen again. Now, I really firmly believe that as we move this process along, that our need to be able to distinguish between abuse with harm and abuse without harm, or neglect without harm, or inappropriate, some of the things that James was talking about that will be something that we're working on, will be very important. But I think for now, I think it's an important tool for us to have. And I also want to remind people that as we diversify our system, and we have more and more families hiring in-home assistance, seniors hiring in-home assistance, and the recognition that many of the things that happen do not come to the level of a criminal investigation, respite providers, etc. This becomes a tool for a very diversified population, not simply facilities, programs that have personnel and personnel policies, which brings me to one point that was someone brought to my attention just a few minutes ago, and that is in our definition of facility, we're not addressing all these folks that are currently served in, or potentially, and we need to look at the statute, but potentially served in apartments and supported living in other areas. So we need to just make sure that we're covering all of those areas. Again, I think that we are very supportive of the information being provided to family members. I think that our recommendation to the department in terms of providing information to families or clients, we need to sit down, look at some best practices and sharing information. We have a huge range of capacity among people to understand information. We need to look at some best practices there. We need to test out some strategies for ways we keep families, guardians, and others informed about what's happening. But I think that, again, it is kind of opening the window and allowing some, you know, light into something that has been a very secret and hidden process. And as someone who's had her son in programs and facilities for almost 10 years, I can tell you that there is so much that I did not know about what's going on in his own homes with staff that served three people, and staff that would disappear, or things that I would hear. I think that this opens that door to accountability that is critically important if we're all going to be involved in keeping people safe and improving the quality of our services. So we strongly support this as a first step, and we'll be working with Representative Gelser on any of the issues and working with the department to make sure that as we move forward to 2009, we're coming to you with a bigger package to address the broader issues.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I just, Catherine, you mentioned your son. On the issue of this database, if your son was concerned about something that was happening in his home or something was happening to him, what kind of ability does he have to share that information with you or his case manager?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, he is not verbal, and he is not able to express verbally any of his concerns. He expresses his concerns usually through very challenging behavior, and it takes other people to be looking at what's going on around him to be able to express those.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
Madam Chair, if I may, I did see one additional note that I had that I just wanted to put on the table. The issue of whether or not we have the ability to capture in a database or need to capture in a database those situations in which somebody resigns when an allegation is made against them, and then a county or a jurisdiction doesn't in fact do an investigation because they say, well, he's not going to be here anymore. If one of the goals of this is to give the tools to facilities and to the individuals and caseworkers about people that are problems out there, as far as potential abuse, I think we need to look at how, if we can, potentially capture that that population as well. Otherwise, you're going to have these people that, if something comes up, they resign and they hop to another facility because these are low-wage jobs very much in demand by the facilities. So,
thank you, Brian. At some point, not today, I don't want to go into it today, but I'm just still appalled that the Oregonian was able to get this registry and that somehow the department didn't get this. I'd like to hear someday just a short presentation on how that could be. Thank you very much. Any questions of this panel? Thank you very
much. Thank you very much.
And is there anyone else? Oh, Lauren Rhodes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lauren Rhodes with the Oregon Healthcare Association, and I promise to be brief. I wanted to thank Representative Geltzer for the opportunity to get involved in this bill. It's been very last minute. I only learned of our inclusion within this a couple days ago, so we've been having some very last-minute conversations, and I think we have arrived at a good point where we are supportive of a lot of the changes that are encompassed in this draft that I've seen most recently. And as Representative Geltzer mentioned earlier, there are some significant changes proposed in this draft in terms of how long-term care facilities would be assessed fees for their license, annual or biannual license and license renewals. And what we would like to see included, and as was referenced earlier, is some statutory parameters around those license fees. We currently have those in existence, and we'd like to continue that parameter, but also are willing to expand and increase the dollar amount associated with those fees. And we are intending to have some conversations with the department, and we'll have those shortly, and in anticipation of the introduction of this bill in February, I think we can have an agreement, and I don't see any problems with that. What we're really just looking at is making sure that these dollar amounts are reasonable. I mean, for all intents and purposes, we always are in agreement with the department on their level of severity and the penalties that they determine are appropriate based on the incident, and we just want to make sure that we continue to have that sort of protection and reasonableness associated with that. And in that vein, we're very supportive of the delivery of those dollars in terms of the license fees and the civil monetary penalties into a quality, I think it's the Quality Care Fund. Right now, they aren't captured always within the departments. They can be used for other programs and services within the state agency or beyond. And right now, you know, we are supportive of keeping those within the program area so that they can be used to enhance the delivery of care and the general quality of life that residents receive in long-term care facilities. So we would like to be able to see those maintained within the seniors and people with physical disabilities program area when they come from those providers, because it makes sense to enhance those services that are delivered, and particularly with training and technical assistance and quality improvement initiatives. It's really where we could see some good improvement made. So thank you for the opportunity to be a part of it, and we look forward to being supportive in February, and happy to take any questions.
Or not. Representative Gilliam.
Madam Chair, you mentioned earlier that we would have plenty of time to talk about this, and you're always very good about asking fiscal impact. So when we start talking about these fees, I just want to be sure we'll talk about fiscal impact and those issues.
That will come after. This is just the first part of the
And
process.
You would prefer not to hear my hour-long speech about fiscal impact.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Lauren. Doug Barber.
Maybe some short questions real quick.
Yes.
And just for Representative Gilliam, we are sending the LC draft to fiscal early, so they're getting a big jump on looking at these before we get to February.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just, for the record, I went to do some checking about the database. After the database ran on the Oregonian, I called them to ask what they invested in terms of technology, and it was just their tech person that put it up. I know that there was a lot of front-end work that went into that in terms of the Department of collecting the information, and there was a public information request, and I did check with the Oregonian last week to find out how much they were billed for that, and it was less than $3,000.
Thank you. Doug?
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Doug Barber. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. I'm trying to figure out who this bill applies to. And when I saw it yesterday for the first time, Representative Gelser said it applied to adult DD homes. But the definitions in Section 2, where it talks about a facility and being a residential facility as defined in ORS 443.400, I looked up what that is. There are five, as I read it, five different kinds of residential facilities that are included. There's no reference to adults. Two of the five apply to folks with who are mentally retarded or developmentally disabled, but the others apply to a huge range of programs, including those residential care facility applies to socially dependent individuals, which is not defined, and I don't know what that is. Residential treatment facilities apply to people with who are emotionally disturbed, mentally disturbed, behaviorally disturbed. The way I read that, also alcohol and drug dependent persons. The way I read that, it would apply to people in the children in the child welfare BRS system, behavioral rehabilitation services system. It would apply to the entire A&D system. It would apply to the mental health, children's mental health system. Could even apply to the Oregon Youth Authority behavioral rehabilitation services system. So I'm just trying to find out whether the bill is intended to apply to all of those different people. And if it is, then I don't have any judgment about the bill. I haven't talked to anybody about any of my clients about it. I'm trying to figure out whether I need to do that or if it really is going to be limited to the adult DD system.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, the intention is for it to be limited to the adult DD system. And when you look in Section 2 where it talks about creating and maintaining a database containing all substantiated complaints of abuse, if you pop down to line 19, it gives the definition of abuse, and that is the definition that applies to adults with developmental disabilities. So that's where that limitation is. You're not going to have a child that's substantiated for abuse to an adult with a developmental disability.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. But back in on lines 5, 6, and 7 in that same section, DHS shall create and maintain a database containing all substantiated complaints of abuse that occur in a facility.
Correct. But if you look, the last line there is containing all substantiated complaints of abuse. And then if you pop down in that same section, abuse has the meaning given that term in ORS 430-735. So it's substantiated cases of abuse under that definition in statute. So it's substantiated abuse of adults with developmental disabilities that occur in a facility.
But a facility is defined, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, obviously, this is an issue that's probably not going to be settled here today. So it looks like this is an issue that's going to be settled with ELSI then.
I appreciate that the idea is to be limited there, and
right.
I would ask that definition of facility in lines 20, 21, 22 somehow then be amended. Maybe it's just with a simple statement that says this is not intended to apply to children's programs in any facility.
Or maybe it needs to say something. This is definitely what this applies to, not just what it does not apply to.
Maybe that.
So, but I'm assuming
or only applies to. Great. Thank you very much.
Do that. Thank you, Doug. Thank you for your concerns. Anyone else who wants to talk briefly on this, LC? Okay. Is that right? Yeah. I will close the public hearing on LC 87 and open up a work session on LC 87.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 87 be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 special session.
Representative Kotek moves that LC 87 be recommended for introduction at February 2008 special session. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, I greatly appreciate what Representative Gelser has done with this. And I mean, she's absolutely, with some of the testimony she's provided us and the homework and everything, has caused me to look at this entirely different, realizing that we have a serious problem here, an area that, I don't have an expertise in. But as I've listened to a lot of the testimony this morning, I have some concerns as to, is this ready to move forward even to the floor for further work rather than hold off and continue pounding it out with everybody, all the stakeholders involved in this.
Well, it'll come back to committee. It won't go to the floor.
Well, I know, but I'm really thinking that this is going to take some time. I mean, maybe several months to get this ready. You know, I understand the urgency behind it as well. But I'm struggling right now with wanting to move this forward at this time because I don't feel that it's ready to the point to even do a little bit more homework on it and everything and then have us move it on the House floor someday here within this next month. I would actually like to see a whale of a lot more time and effort involved in it to just really get a lot of the nooks and crannies all squared away with it. So.
I know, Representative, you want to speak, but I think it is an emergency situation. I think that there is evidence that there is abuse going on, and there is not, if the Oregonian can put together a registry, I think it's incumbent upon the state to do that to make sure that this kind of abuse is not continuing. We can stop it as much as possible. But thank you for your sharing this with us, your thoughts on this. Representative Gelsick.
Thank you. And I just wanted to echo that. I agree that there is a lot of work to be done on this issue that can't be done in 3 weeks. And many of the issues that were raised, for example, by Mr. DeLashmet, are not issues that are unique or inherent or increased by this bill. They are issues that are going to take longer to hammer out, and we will be coming back to work on those in 2009. But those are not new problems that are created by this bill. I think this situation has opened up for discussion among all of the stakeholders, kind of this simmering issue about problems that we have within our system, problems that we have about investigation. This won't worsen them. This will shine greater light on them. It will help us have more information, and it will better inform those discussions so that when we come back in 2009, we can have an even better fix. And I kind of liken it to, the choice of not doing anything until we can do everything that we know that we need to do, or taking a bridge. I really look at this as a bridge to 2009, to doing the pieces that we can to protect the people that we can while we work to, fix the issues with continuity of investigation across the state and improving issues around training. All of those things are very, very important. We can't do them in February, but we can do this. And for, kids like, not kids, but adults like Catherine's son, who can't tell us when there's a problem, this registry, this database is going to help tell their parents and their case managers when there is a problem so that we can keep them safe. And I don't want them to have to wait another year to get it. And I agree with Representative Tomei. If the Oregonian can put this online with information that's publicly available already, absolutely the state should be making this available as well.
Okay. Any further discussion? All right. Would you take the roll, please?
Representative Cowan.
Yes.
Representative
Gillian.
Excused. Representative
Kotek.
Aye.
Representative
Howell.
Excused. Vice Chair
Gelser.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson.
No.
Aye. Having received the constitutional majority, this legislative concept will be introduced in February. So I will now close the work session on legislative concept 87. And I will open up an informational meeting on the prevention and treatment of problem gambling in Oregon. Moving up. pretty quietly, but why don't we start?
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Bob Nickel, and I'm the Assistant Director for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. About a little over 1% of my budget is in the gambling, addiction, and prevention program area. So we're pleased that you've invited us to come. And as I understand it, we had an update, we had an introduction to this issue about a year ago before your committee, and we appreciate you bringing us back to talk a little bit more. Today I have Wendy Hossatter, who's been a longtime staff person in the program, and also I'm pleased on his second day on the job to introduce Paul Potter, who has been chair of the Gambling Addiction Foundation board for the last number of years, and very pleased to have Paul join us on our staff just yesterday.
Great.
I guess it was Monday.
Tuesday.
That's right. Monday was the holiday. So thank you again for inviting us. We're going to walk through some slides here. I hope the technology will work. I believe we also provided you with this information in hard copy, too, although I don't know if it's arriving now. So I want to walk through quite a bit of data about the nature and the magnitude of the problem, but more importantly, toward the second half of our time, I'd really like to talk with you more about what's working, what we see as some of the challenges, and some potential directions to consider in the future. So I will move ahead, and Wendy and Paul will help me out if I get stumped here on any of the detailed questions. So the first point is a really broad one, and that is simply that Oregon has more legalized gambling and offers easier access to gambling than almost any other state in the country. So we're starting off with an availability. As one of my key managers says, it's a target-rich environment. There are a lot of potential issues here that come as a result of that.
I think also, that is a startling statement. I think if I've heard that before, I'd forgotten it. That is amazing.
That's the first time we've heard that described that way.
And, you know, along with that, certently on the positive side, Oregon is a nationally recognized leader in prevention, harm reduction, and treatment for gambling problems. There's still a lot we have to learn, but I think Oregon really will go down in history as a real pioneer in not only having the access and the availability, but also doing something concrete about it. And the fact that 1% of the proceeds from the lottery fund do go to gambling addiction and treatment is a great step forward that the state made a number of years ago. So greater access plus greater acceptance, and there's probably an increasing amount of acceptance just because of availability in Oregon to gambling. We have more problem gamblers, and as a result, more consequences from that. Just some quick numbers. I'm sorry the technology isn't on board yet, but we have a nationally recognized researcher named Tom Moore who has done a lot of the research for us on this and nationally. And his research shows that 74,000 Oregon adults, or about 2% of our adults, have some form of adult problem or pathological gambling issue. I think even more startling than that is a study that he did 10 years ago now that showed about 30,000 youth also have some form of a difficulty with that. We're updating that study. It will not surprise us if we see that number go up considerably, and I don't want to speculate whether it could reach 40,000, but just given the increase in population size and the increased awareness and availability of gambling, that it may approach that. And also want to point out that 6,000 of the 74,000 Oregon adults are over 62 years of age. The cost of problem gambling, again, this is fairly well-researched. Studies show that 25 to 50% of the spouses of problem gamblers are abused. 10 to 17% of children of problem gamblers are either neglected or abused. And against all of these numbers, we have been able to engage about 2,000, specifically 1,986 people are receiving treatment in Oregon for fiscal year 06-07. The average gambling debt was a little over $26,000. Many people believe that's probably underestimated, as in any kind of addiction problem.
Sure. It seems like we're having trouble. These are the same overheads here. We'll just go with these.
I apologize for the problem. Average gambling debt is $26,000, probably an underestimate given the kind of denial and minimization that happens with any kind of addiction problems. I'm sure most of you are familiar. 57% have jeopardized or lost a significant relationship or job. 21% committed illegal acts to obtain gambling money. Almost 30% had alcohol problems. 12% had other drug problems. 21%, one in five, reported suicidal thoughts. 7% reported making at least one attempt. If you turn to the dollars involved, socioeconomic cost for pathological gambler for each one is estimated between $11,000 and over $3,000 for each what's described here as subclinical pathological gambler. Pathological gambler is the most severe category of diagnosis for problem gambling, and subclinical pathological gambler would be a lesser disorder. If those figures are generalized to Oregon, the annual socioeconomic cost of problem gambling has been estimated at almost $450 million. That's an annual estimate. As we mentioned, 74,000 Oregon adults need treatment. The system is currently treating about 2,000. Just by way of perspective, that's not a highly unusual rate for getting people into treatment in the addiction area in general. We usually expect to see about 5% roughly of people with alcohol and drug problems in treatment at any given time, so this is not terribly out of line with that. But it speaks to the difficulties of getting people with problems to come forward until they've really reached a more severe level. We believe we have about an 81% success rate. And that would be defined operationally as people either in treatment stop gambling completely or reduce their gambling significantly. We did some, if you use those kinds of assumptions and some of the economic assumptions, for about $10 million in treatment investment, the state is probably seeing about a $98 million savings, not to the state directly, but to people within Oregon. So it seems to me to be a good investment. We've given a couple of examples in your materials of problem gamblers. I won't go through those in detail, other than to say that often people are above average intelligence. They're pretty high functioning usually, often, though not always employed. They're not the typical user of social services. And it's probably a little bit easier to hide even than alcohol and drug problems. The co-occurrence of alcohol and drug abuse problems is estimated at about 30 to 50%. Particular comment in your material has to do with female gamblers, often seen as more escape gamblers. Gambling soothes feelings and reduces stress, at least in the short run. Not unlike alcohol and drug usage, people use for reasons. And if alcohol and drugs and gambling didn't make people feel temporarily better in some way, they'd probably not as likely to use it, but we all know that it doesn't stop quite there. Often childhood trauma of some kind is an underlying dynamic. Again, there are some examples I'm going to just kind of skip over because I really want to have time to talk a little bit more.
We've got a question here.
Yes.
Our wonderful staff.
Thank you, Chair. And this is maybe the odd question, but I'm just curious now. I've been hearing this medication ad on TV about if you feel the compulsion to gamble, take this medication. Is somebody at some point going to talk about there must be some sort of psycho or active reason for people gambling and why this medication would affect it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think I'll ask Paul to introduce himself for the record and then answer that question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, well, first of all, I want to thank you all for having some interest in this topic and also ask to sort of be held harmless since this is my third day on the job here. But I do have an answer to your question.
Put your name on the record.
Oh, yeah. For the record, my name is Paul Potter. I'm the Problem Services Gambling Manager. Problem Gambling Services Manager. I'm obviously so new in the job, I don't even know my title.
Soon you'll know what you do.
Yes. Thank you. What you're referring to is Mirapex, I believe, and it is a medication that's recently been put on the market to treat restless leg syndrome. And they do have one of those long list of contraindications and says if you please tell your doctor if you experience any of these symptoms, and they tell you all these really horrible things. And in this case, one of them is if you experience increased urges to gamble. And that's, I've heard that myself. The where it relates to, I believe, and I'm not a scientist or from the Federal Drug Administration, but there is a correlation in the brain on any addictive processes. And so if you have a medication that somehow would trigger that part of the brain that may increase urges to be involved in a an addictive process, they've experienced this obviously in clinical trials with gambling. So that's what I know about that, that's popped up out of clinical trials, and they were required to put that contraindication on that when they put that on the market.
Bob, while we stop for a second, I'm going to do... Did I lose anybody? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I've got 5 people because people come and go. I'm going to recess the information.
You just reopen a work session.
Okay, I'm just going to reopen the work session on LC 87 and... allow. I need a motion to suspend rules to allow Representative Gilliam to vote yes on LC 87 to be introduced in February.
Madam Chair, I move that we suspend the rules so Representative Gilliam could cast his vote on LC 87.
Yes,
do I have 5 members agreeing to that? Everybody agree? All right. Representative Gilliam, how do you vote?
Aye.
Great. Do I need to say anything more? Okay, I'll close the work session. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just continuing on with the issue of the Healthy Teens survey of 2006 asked questions, and you have a slide on this. But basically, it shows, the correlation, and this is not causative, but the co-occurrence of alcohol and drug usage with gambling addiction is pretty strong. And so as we think about the issues related particularly to youth, we have to keep in mind the continued issues that, you know, I've appeared before you and other committees many times to talk about our concerns about youth, alcohol, and drug usage. I mentioned already that from a funding and administration perspective, 1% of the lottery revenues are dedicated to a gambling treatment fund.
How much of that is actually given? What percentage is actually given to that treatment fund?
Madam Chair, 13.1% of that is actually allocated to the department. So even if we were able to spend more than $13.1 million, we would have to come back to the legislature to get that additional allocation. That's an issue that we'd like to at least talk about at some point in the future, not necessarily today, but
right.
We did want to highlight that as one of the concerns.
Right, and I definitely want to bring that up in the future, probably not in February, but certainly in the 09 session.
Madam Chair, can I follow up on the 13.1, Bob? How much of it gets right down to the grassroots?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, $11.1 million gets right down to the grassroots. Now, the $2 million gap is explained by our several issues. One, we have three and a half staff, FTE, in the office. They don't make $2 million a year, so we know that there are also other administrative costs, there's services and supplies. The evaluation process, which I think is a very critical piece of this, and our data system are contracted out at this point. That's an issue that Paul and I will be talking about as he gets oriented a little bit more. Do we want to continue to outsource our evaluation and data system, or is that something that we should do as a state? I don't have a strong bias one way or the other. I just think that we should look at it. I would suggest that it might be helpful for us to get a more detailed breakdown, though, for you to show you exactly where that $2 million gap between what hits the ground and what we actually get into my division into the department goes for. So I appreciate the question, and in looking at it, if I were you, I would want a more detailed breakdown, and we can get that for you.
Good.
There's a chart that shows the gap between what's actually 1% of the gambling revenue or the lottery revenue and the amount that we've had allocated to us. It's clear to me that we've closed the gap. It's still an issue. I'd like to keep track of it. Maybe that as we may be closing the gap for 2007-09, but we need to see what the projections are for increased lottery revenue and then where we would be at if we continue to have the kind of allocation that we've had. So just an issue that we wanted to raise for your awareness. Again, we've got some more charts in here that describe some of this information in more graphic form. In the area of prevention and outreach, we think that it's really critical, and we appreciate just having the opportunity to have a hearing here and provide this information, but increasing awareness of this issue generally is certainly on our agenda. We particularly recognize we need to help youth make good choices as they continue to have exposure to this. And we continue to want to get more people into treatment, particularly knowing that treatment is effective and it reduces the costs and the social and other family problems that people have. We do have a problem gambling helpline, which is part of what the fund provides for. 2,435 calls for help, I believe that was in the last year. 91% of those calls resulted in a referral. I think that's an incredibly positive sign that a problem gambling helpline does make a difference.
If we have a further hearing in February, could you also break that down and how many people who made that call were actually the gamblers or the relatives or friends or employees?
Thank you, Chair. We'll try to break that down. We have 17 regional problem gambling awareness outreach and prevention programs. We've shared with you in your handouts a treatment, a continuum of care, and I won't go through that whole graphic because I think it's pretty self-explanatory. We have a gambling evaluation and reduction program. We have a corrections program, 27 outpatient treatment centers, 3 crisis respite programs, and as far as we know, Paul and Wendy helped me on this, the first of its kind in the country, at least a publicly funded residential treatment program.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think there are other national programs, but completely dedicated to gambling addiction treatment. I believe we are one of the first in the nation to have a residential program specifically dedicated to gamblers.
We have additional demographic information on one of the charts, pretty evenly split between males and females. Average age for the people who are enrolled in our publicly funded programs is 45 years. Average household income of $36,000. Full-time job is 50.3%. That would be a higher number, except that there are a fairly large number, as we mentioned, of people 62 and older, and many of them may be retired, so that decreases the percentage overall of people who are employed. But generally, this is a population of people who have work skills, and many of whom have worked and are currently working.
And maybe you could get us the age differential in future hearings so that we know how many people under retirement age have a full-time job and how many.
I'm sure we will do that.
Thank you.
Primary locations, probably not a great surprise that lottery retailers and video machines are the primary location for 72%. The next highest would be casinos.
And I think that is an issue that we need to be looking at in the future. These are like foxes and...
One of the next charts shows you the trend. It's a pretty obvious upward trend since 1995-96 when we started the program, from a little over 500 enrollments up to approaching well over 2,000 at this we project for this biennium. What's working? I mentioned already the treatment approaches, although there aren't as clear evidence-based approaches yet in many other fields, mainly because it's a newer field. We do see that 81% of the clients who are enrolled report either no gambling or reduced gambling at 6 months post-treatment. I think that's a good indicator. And on the positive side, Oregon is one of the few states that appears to have averted a significant increase in problem gambling, even though we've expanded legalized gambling. The challenges I want to spend just a little bit of time talking about. People, as we've indicated, are often hidden. They're not easily engaged, although, again, I think that's not a terribly different phenomenon from addiction treatment in general, but it's an issue we really have to be aware of as we design our programs. At this point, there's no mandated treatment. We're not proposing that we go that direction, but just for information purposes, there isn't a mandate like there is in civil commitment or often with people with alcohol and drug problems. I assume that there's probably some legal potential for that, but we're not proposing that. We're just providing that as information at this point. I mentioned that evidence-based practices are still evolving. The overall lack of awareness probably of most citizens about the nature and the magnitude of the problem keeps it off the radar screen, and we again appreciate the chance to bring it onto the screen a little bit more. There are other unique challenges. There's no federal agency involved in this, as there is with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA. There are few or no advocacy groups, and there are few spokespeople yet for recovery. I suspect that that's, that kind of thing will be changing and evolving as time goes along. And one of the things that I think we need to work on, particularly within our department, is not allowing our silos to keep us from dealing with people who truly come to us with more than one problem issue. And I think the fact that this is nested in the addictions and mental health division at this point is a good place, but we also need to recognize we need to work across the department boundaries with child welfare and with seniors and persons with disabilities, and also into the corrections area. We also need to be challenged to find more specific interventions for adolescents, as we've mentioned, the Hispanic populations, Native Americans, etc. Some people have wondered whether a gambling court might be of some use for people who get into criminal types of situations, primarily as a result of their gambling addiction problem. The other key need, and this is something that I think we can do something within our department about, and we're talking about, we set up our reimbursement system for providers on a very strict and sometimes overly rigid fee-for-service system. And if you're running a business and you need a cash flow in order to expand, when there's obviously an expanded opportunity here to bring more people in. So we're going to be looking at whether there's a way to provide a little bit more of a cushion in terms of cash flow for programs, rather than always have to bill, and then, you know, although I think we have an efficient system for reimbursing them, it's always after the fact. And so we're going to be looking at whether there's some other ways to do our reimbursement while still maintaining the accountability that we expect and that I know the legislature expects. So just to summarize, the key needs that we see are: problem gambling needs to be viewed and treated as a fairly common and usually co-occurring disorder with other issues. For youth, I've mentioned that we really need to get a better handle on what youth are doing and what our prevention approaches might be in that area. We also need to study on the effectiveness of client identification and outreach. We need to continue to monitor quality of care and work on new partnerships. I mentioned that we are taking a look at our payment mechanisms, and as I mentioned earlier, the trying to approach more of a one-to-one relationship between the allocation and the budget authority.
Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, Madam Chair, the issue is that we've had to come back to rebalancing or other legislative forums to get a change in our budget authority. When we began to project that we would exceed our budget authority to get to the allocation. So it's not a question of changing the 1% allocation. It's a matter of, you know, spending time with you. We think maybe unnecessarily getting the budget authority to come back into line with actual need, and still it would still be within the 1% allocation.
So in essence, the 1% that the legislature has said that you should get for treatment and prevention has not been given to you to fully expend.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And you know, there's no fault here. It's simply that we don't always know what the gambling revenue is going to be, and then we can't always predict exactly how many people we're going to be able to engage in treatment. So, but it's something we would like a chance to talk further with the legislature
about. And you haven't talked at all about the advertising that you've been doing recently on television and in billboards. Can you talk briefly about that?
Madam Chair, I think I'm going to let Wendy describe that, and Paul can add anything else.
I'm Wendy Hausotter with Addictions and Mental Health, Problem Gambling Prevention and Outreach Coordinator. And actually, the ads that you've seen have been sponsored by the lottery. So the person who could speak to that is your lottery representatives here.
Great. Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is probably some data point to bring back to us in the future. But back to the slide around spouses abused and children neglected or abused, what number are we talking about? What percentage of these are based on the 74,000 number, I'm assuming, or of the people that you're seeing in treatment?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, Wendy reminds me, these are based on national prevalence studies and other demographic reviews, so we don't have the capacity at this point to do those studies here in Oregon. We'd be happy to, but we've got a limited amount of funds, but those are national studies, and we can get some of those national studies to you in more detail if you'd like to look at them.
Thank you. Follow up, thank you. I would. I guess where I'm going with this line of questioning is, if we have a substantial problem in the state of children being connected with child welfare because their parents are addicted to gambling, and I don't have a good sense of how many that is that the population we want to mandate treatment for those parents so they have priority in the slots to get treated because their kids are going to end up not taken care of in foster care? I mean, there, you know, Where can we target some of the populations where there's an overlap of services that will cost us money down the line? So that would be helpful if we could get, and it might be a small number, it might be a large number. I don't have a good sense.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I think it's an excellent idea, and it's the kind of thing that we're ideally positioned to do, not only because this is not a poorly funded program overall. I mean, we talk about the margin between the allocation and the budget authority, but we have a fairly a significant source of funding, and we have a close working relationship within the department with children, adults, and families. I think that's a fertile area to take a look at. Thank you for suggesting that.
Thank you. Another question. Thank you for that response. On the triangle that you have here, the pyramid, so $11 million, so you have the $2 million in admin and evaluation and staff, which for 3.5 staff and evaluation, it's not that much money, you know, because that's for a biennial number. But for the $2.7 million in prevention and outreach, I'm just, and maybe it's a question for the lottery folks, can we shift some of that somewhere else so more of the $2.7 can go into treatment? I'm trying to get a sense of how that $2.7 is spent within your 1% that you get. Is there overlap? Can we move that more into treatment? I'm just wondering if you've talked about adjusting that at all.
Madam Chair, I'll let Paul or Wendy talk about where the $2.7 million in prevention outreach currently goes, and I think they're better prepared to deal with that.
Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, Wendy and my predecessor have worked at developing both the treatment programs and working on the allocation system and the spread between prevention and treatment. That is a division on decision in terms of how that money is distributed. I think this is a fair distribution of that money right now. There are not treatment providers right now in the state of Oregon that are not getting the money they need for gamblers that are approaching for treatment. So, which is not to say that we don't need to develop that, increase our awareness and client identification for people who need that. But so that I think those prevention and outreach efforts are critical right now to make sure that we get the message out there that treatment is available for people, that it is working, and that it's available.
So, just Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, the prevention piece and outreach piece is never done at the expense of treatment. It's a fluid system, so if we needed to, we could cut back. So far, we haven't needed to do that. And the idea was to take a public health approach so that we weren't just treating people, but we were looking ahead to, you know, preventing people from having problems in the future. And most of these funds are at the local level. So in addition to the statewide media campaign that the lottery does, our office coordinates and works with the 17 local folks who are in your areas, who are working with your schools, working with your community coalitions, you know, sort of the grassroots prevention and outreach. So the lottery does the big statewide media, but there's a whole other piece of prevention that is in our responsibility area, and that's where that money goes.
Thank you, and I think so. It's the clarification about there's part of it that is done by the lottery now, and then you're doing more at the local level, and you're feeling this is a good. I agree. We have to do prevention. It's just, although I'm sensing you feel like you can't. Your capacity is fine right now, in terms of you don't have how many. What's your waiting list?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I think that was the shorthand way of saying it is we don't have a waiting list at the local level.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that train of thought a little bit, I guess, because I do see a real need for outreach, particularly in this area, to help people understand that they perhaps have a problem and do need to seek treatment. And so it would be interesting as we develop the conversations to see what kind of correlation the treatment providers might have experienced with relationship to some sort of a promotional effort or outreach program. My thought process was running to the TV blackout when we did the program on meth addictions, and I got some report from providers that their phone lines rang all night and they were immediately full. I mean, you know, this outreach resulted in this group seeking treatment, and so I'm just using that as an example. That it would be interesting to see if we could relate what's working and what increases people's response and going to treatment. So.
Representative Callan and Madam Chair, we are actually right now in the process of conducting a study that looks exactly at that.
What a brilliant idea.
Yes.
Thank you.
We should have the results in about 6 months. So we're looking at what's going on the state level, what each of the individual counties and regions are doing, because we want to know the answer to that question.
Thanks.
Any other questions? This panel? Thank you all so much. Appreciate it. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we also have Dale Penn and Carol Hardy. I'm going to try again, huh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll introduce myself, Dale Penn. I'm director of the lottery. And this issue of problem gambling and the issue of a healthy player base and prevention of problem gambling is an issue that's important to the Lottery Commission, both from a business sense but from a moral sense as well. And so these concepts are part of our strategic plan, start part of our business plans, and our issues that we have a variety of levels that we work on. What I've asked today is, Carol Hardy is one of the four assistant directors for the lottery. She has a marketing background and is charged in the marketing department, but she's also worked in the area of messaging to the public, and including problem gambling and responsible gaming is what we would call that. That 97% of the population that may engage in gambling that perhaps is not at risk to be a problem gambler.
And you have those figures, Dale?
I think you heard earlier, Madam Chair, the figure was between, and I think nationally you would hear, between 2-3% is usually the amount that is identified as the target population.
That 2-3% of the total
of the
population, or
yeah,
the gambling population?
Of the total population.
Thank you. Okay, that's what it's after.
So we do have this treatment program that you've heard about. And
while I'm stopping on that, I'm going to ask you another question. Could you get us the figures for the people who perhaps gamble regularly? What percentage of that would be problem gamblers?
Madam Chair, I don't know if we have research that would establish that. I have to draw a distinction between the lottery and Department of Human Services. We do not engage in treatment at all.
Right.
And so we become a funding source just through the state process to provide those dollars through the legislature to DHS. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about different research, we do try to assist in funding research, but I don't know that we would have that exact, and we don't actually do the research ourselves. But I'll ask, perhaps Carol would have some information to assist you on that topic.
Great.
Just let me give one other comment about this, and then we'll have Ms. Hardy present really some more detailed information about this. I want to emphasize this is an important point for the commission as well as the lottery. And when you hear the discussion about one of the challenges for DHS being awareness and keeping it on the radar screen, that is really part of the challenge that the lottery has tried to assume in this endeavor. And so when you discuss different advertising in this area, that is something that we're very much engaged in, and we believe it from the perspective of preventing problem gambling and keeping a healthy player base that it makes business sense. Because the lottery constitutionally must always come back to our job is to run the business of providing these gaming or gambling games. And so we have to hook it back to a business motivation, but having a healthy player base is certainly a strong business motivation.
And when you say healthy player base, you mean healthy in the terms of they're getting a lot of money coming into the lottery. You don't mean, you're including people who might have a problem.
Yes, and Madam Chair, and I'll let Ms. Hardy talk about this more, but trying to make sure that problem gamblers do receive treatment and are able to be healthy and do not have impacts on others, family members and others, that have an economic impact on the state and perhaps on the player base for the lottery. But then also preventing and helping our primary player base, that 97%, that they not get to the point of becoming problem gamblers, so that they are able to see this as entertainment, a long-term type of situation, that they have fun, they set a budget, they set a time on it. So that is part of our messaging as well. So, as I say, this challenge that DHS has identified, I think that's been there for a number of years. And so one of our performance measures that we try to track is, can we show that the call rate seeking assistance is increasing each year? And we try to use our advertising and our programs to help increase that reaching out, because that is the biggest challenge. Right now, there is sufficient treatment slots. It is getting that problem gambler to pick up the phone or to walk into a treatment location or to seek assistance. So that has become a big focus of some of the ads that we'll show you here today. With that, I'll be happy. I'll be here to answer any questions you might have of me. But as I said, Ms. Hardy will give you much more detail in this area.
Okay. Good morning, Chair, to my representatives. Again, for the record, my name is Carol Hardy, and I'm the Assistant Director for Marketing with the Oregon Lottery. I've been with the organization for 19-plus years and have been involved in the problem gambling outreach effort since the mid-1990s. Probably will repeat some of what Director Penn had said, but just to try to step through what our efforts are. Problem gambling outreach is supported by the Oregon Lottery in two ways. The first we've had quite a bit of discussion about is 1% of Oregon Lottery profits fund treatment programs throughout Oregon, and that is a statutory dedication. And we do appreciate the legislators' support in continuing to dedicate that money, and this biennium was the first in several where the full 1% was dedicated at the beginning of the biennium, and that's very important. The second thing that we do is annually the lottery itself dedicates a portion of our administrative money to fund outreach and education programs, and that is at the direction of the Oregon Lottery Commission. The Oregon Lottery develops our outreach programs based on information gathered through a variety of sources. One very critical one is our partnerships, and the second, research. I'll talk more about those as we go through here. The Oregon Lottery has three distinct outreach programs, and they're directed to different audiences. The first one is problem gambling information regarding treatment. That is directed to problem gamblers and their families. We also have a retailer training program that's directed to Oregon Lottery retailers. And we have a responsible gaming program that Director Penn was just alluding to, which is directed to anyone who plays games, whether there are games or any other games. It's a message to Oregonians. Director Penn also referred to annual targets and measures. We have two that are related back to these programs. One is to increase the number of problem gamblers who seek treatment by 10% year over year. We have achieved or exceeded that target for all the period that we've had that measurement in place. One of the ways, the beauty of being able to do this is there's a phone number associated with those ads, and we track the number of people through the Problem Gambling Helpline that respond. So it's a very trackable measure.
Carol, I'm going to stop here.
Sure.
So you mentioned retailer training. What is that?
So I will talk about that a little more in detail as I go through. I can stop now if you'd prefer.
That's fine.
Okay. The second measure is that we train 100% of our new retailers on problem gambling. And again, that's a measure that we have achieved, a target that we have achieved every year since that's been tracked. I think it's very critical to talk about our partnerships because the Oregon Lottery can't possibly do what we do without a lot of input from experts. One of our critical partnerships is with the Department of Human Services. I've worked very closely with Wendy and Paul in a different capacity, and certainly Dr. Jeff Murata, who had the previous position of the Problem Gambling Services Manager. I'm a member of the board of the Oregon Problem Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that is a champion for this issue in Oregon. They are tasked with doing research and outreach. There's membership in that committee from treatment providers, gamblers in recovery, the tribes, their subject matter experts, concerned individuals, and the lottery has been a member of that organization since it began.
Carol, could you send out the whole committee information on that that foundation?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Another group is the Problem Gambling Treatment and Prevention groups that Wendy Hausetter had talked about just before this. We attend all their meetings. We invite them to give email to me on their comments, their issues, and try to incorporate their needs into our programs. We work with the National Council on Problem Gambling. The director, Keith White, is someone that I work with directly. We have actually sponsored some national advertising that is run on their website. We also work with other gaming associations to learn from them. That would include lotteries, casinos, anyone who deals with gambling. And also we currently continue to work with Dr. Jeff Murata. He now has his own consulting firm called Problem Gambling Solutions. We continue to consult with him as a subject matter expert that's been recognized across the United States as being a leading expert. The other thing that we do is research. This has also been discussed, is the entity in Oregon that conducts that research is the Oregon Problem Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation, and we have helped fund three adult prevalence studies and a youth study. And to go back to Representative Tomei's question about what measures are in that study, I will go back and look to see how that data is broken down. We may be able to provide you the answer to the question. I couldn't tell you that for sure without going back to look at the study. We also do our own research. One of the things I didn't put on the slide that's an important measure is every 6 months we do a tracking study of Oregonians. And in there we do measure the awareness of problem gambling, and we do measure the awareness of our programs. So that's an ongoing measure to us, one of them to tell how we're doing. The other thing that we do, and we did one very recently, is we ask the public to give us input on our outreach messages to help us make them more effective. Okay. So most recently we conducted research in the fall. I'm sorry.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a measure for how fast problem gambling is growing in Oregon, and is that part of your research?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, that is part of what's measured in the prevalency studies. And we, as I mentioned, there are three of them. I can't give you the exact years, but the first one I think was done in the mid-90s. There's another one around 2000, and then a couple of years ago we did one. And actually what that showed from the first one to the second, there had been a slight increase. And in the third one, it showed a decrease down to close to what the initial study was, which is our indicator that it isn't a growing problem as a percent of the population.
As of what date? What's the latest part of your research?
I believe that, I couldn't tell you 100%. I believe the last study was done in 2005.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. It's apparent that a lot of seniors hit the gambling halls, it seems, and the buses come. With the demographic shift, and we're seeing the upward demographic shift into seniors, is that potentially, and I don't know if seniors comprise a bigger proportion of problem gamblers. I mean, that's the first question. Then will we potentially see a problem with seniors if that is the case?
Churchill, may representative.
No, I'm just
All right. I couldn't tell you 100% the answer to that. Where we get our data is through the Department of Human Services and their association with Emergence, who runs the helpline. Their data shows who seeks treatment. So that's one source of data, and I don't have that in front of me to say what particular age group. And from the prevalence study, I also would have to go back and check the data. That hasn't been expressed to us as a key target. It certainly is one of the groups that you could say there's a particular type of messaging you'd send to those folks. This stems back to when we worked with Dr. Jeff Murata as the Problem Gambling Services Manager, but one of the things he shared with us is who they believe the greater at-risk groups to be. And the targets that we've identified are women in particular, which I think we showed you last time we were in front of you some of our efforts there, and we do have another group of messaging. And the reason for that is the prevalence study shows there's about a 50-50 split of male-female problem gamblers in Oregon. Women problem gamblers were underrepresented in treatment, so they became a target for the advertising. So I know I'm not directly answering it, but I just don't have the data to say that seniors were identified as a particular at-risk area.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you. I think a follow-up on that might be that question could perhaps be broadened for some of the information that the department might help provide too. If you go back to the percentage that I heard earlier, that 72% of problem gamblers are related to, I think I got this correctly, the lottery sorts of problems, and 15% in casino sorts of gambling, which are two different types. And then the question that was referenced, I think, probably relates more to the use of casinos. And so it would be interesting when we look at those prevalence studies, mm-hmm. if we can break out by age demographics two types. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of very different kinds of usage. So.
Mm-hmm. Right, and people have to make a deliberate effort to get to a Native American casino, whereas in the neighborhood just next door to where you work or where you shop, can be one of those.
It can be combined with social outings an opportunity to go out to lunch or dinner and a variety of things, as opposed to in some of the different kinds of facilities, mm-hmm. where you find the lottery games per se. So, but I think those are interesting to break out as we look at all of the information because of that differential between the sort of types of opportunity.
Sure. Yeah. Madam Chair, if I could just put one point in there with that stat of 72%, it is a very complex issue. And since we're talking about people seeking treatment being a very small percentage of those who have a difficulty with gambling, and then overall of all players being even a smaller amount, One of the issues about that, I mentioned that there's many things that the lottery tries to keep in mind in the games that we put out, but how we operate facilities. And so, for instance, in video gaming, in a lottery retailer's location, every one of our machines has the 1-800 number on the machine. I don't think you'd see that anyplace else, but in every lottery location, you're going to see that in every machine. We mandate that retailers must have problem gambling information available, and so this is part of the training program that we're talking about. And so every lottery location has separate material there and focuses on problem gambling as an issue. So we do make a real effort to make sure that lottery players and lottery retailers are aware of this treatment mechanism, and that's just a factor that comes into play as well when we look at who actually seeks assistance.
So, if you don't mind, Stacey, but that just brought up a question that I've been thinking of for some time. So, in places where alcohol is served, then the people who serve the alcohol are trained to identify somebody who is drunk. So, in one of these facilities, gambling facilities, then would the proprietor, the owner, be trained to look for people who are obviously spending more than theoretically they can afford?
Yes, Madam Chair, I simply say that is part of our training program. The difficulty is it is much different in judging whether or not someone is affected by alcohol and then knowing whether or not someone is spending too much money. It's a much more complicated issue, but we do try to identify for them in the training. Here are some indicators. And then also, we live in a free society, so what can you do about it? A retailer can say, gee, you've gone to the ATM 3 times tonight. But it is a much complicated issue, but we do try to assist in that way and give some training and indicators of problem gambling issues.
So I might add, it's coming up later, but just to give a little more detail on that, because you'd already asked also, is we currently have a training program that talks about just those issues. We are in the middle of updating our problem gambling retailer training to expand on the intervention techniques. And what we're looking at is some other jurisdictions, Canadian jurisdictions specifically, that have had responsible gaming programs in place in their jurisdictions for many years, and they have methods where they teach retailers to identify where there may be a player at risk. And the intervention techniques are really directed to having a conversation with someone, providing them information, or talking directly to their family members. So that's a section of our training that we have a business initiative to expand that currently, because it's a sensitive issue, and one that I think just as the problem, people become more aware of and knowledgeable about this particular issue of problem gambling, we keep gathering information and providing more detail, particularly to our retailers who are the ones that are in contact with the folks.
I'm very interested in that, and I hope you keep us updated on how that goes. And we'd like to hear maybe from a retailer and how that experience is working for her.
Okay.
Thank you. President Cowan, I interrupted.
Actually, your train of thought is much along the same lines as mine, and I would just maybe just throw out some elaboration of that. That is a question that keeps running through my mind, and I understand it's like we can no longer serve you alcohol, but we can't necessarily say you can no longer play this machine. But I guess maybe just as you develop information for us, the prevalence rates of high-end use, I guess, of the machines in correlation to the amount of to places that serve alcohol as opposed to those that don't. In other words, do people play a whole lot more than they should when they've been consuming alcohol? And I guess the other thing, I'm wondering about the advisability of the ATM machines in facilities. So. I'm just going to throw those at us.
Yeah.
In the process.
And Madam Chair and Representative Cowan, we can look and see what we can pull from that, but the issue of alcohol, that was a mandate since video began to say that you must have an OLCC license and sell alcohol to be able to have video lottery. And it was designed to be an immediate age control mechanism. So I'd have to say every location that has video lottery sells alcohol.
So if I could just clarify and then I'll stop. So we're really only talking about video lottery as opposed to the scratch-its and that kind of thing. Is that, maybe I just need to understand.
Madam Chair and Representative Cowan, if we're talking about just age control, yes. Now, other products, you have to be 18, but I think that what I hear from treatment people and others is that video is probably a bigger problem than scratch tickets, but there are some people that can be addicted to scratch tickets. It just seems to be a much smaller number.
I would think that. Thank you. I'm sorry to have interrupted there.
Well, and just a point of clarification, the statistics that DHS shared with video lottery, how they phrase it in the reports that I have seen, it's when video lottery is their game of choice. That doesn't mean that's the only game they play. So it's just that that is reported more frequently as their game of choice. Mm-hmm. So if I was talking about the research that we recently conducted, which may be of particular interest to this group, we were testing our messaging to say, where do we go with our messaging to make it more effective? We spoke with a number of different types of people. We spoke with regular lottery players, women problem gamblers in recovery, men problem gamblers in recovery, and friends and family members of problem gamblers. What we heard out of those studies really led us to the executions that we're working on right now. One of the messages we clearly heard is they want believable people to deliver messages. They don't want it to feel like an actor or someone that they feel might be delivering information that's not honest. They wanted very specific information. They wanted to know how treatment helps. They wanted to know what picking up the phone was like. They wanted to know that there was hope. And the other thing that we learned is that women problem gamblers are much more likely than men to seek treatment as a direct result of our messaging to them. So the first audience that we have addressed in campaigns that were just developed are women problem gamblers. And this campaign ran beginning in December, and it ran just 2 weeks ago, January 7th. It will run again February 11th. Television is one of the components, and perhaps you've seen it, but we'd like to play that for you. And this is an actual Oregonian in recovery.
Why I liked it, I don't know. Mesmerized is what I was. I didn't know that gambling didn't affect most people that way. The desperation came from not being able to stop. I had to do something, so I called. She made me understand that there was hope. I haven't placed a bet now for 18 months and no more hiding. If you can't stop gambling, call the number. Go to treatment. It'll work.
Thank you. And there's a print element as well, and this is a tear sheet from the ad that ran. This was in the Oregonian. That's actually in color. The ads in the newspaper are black and white. And this when we run on television, we always run in print because what we find out from the problem gambling hotline, who tracks calls constantly and gives us reports back to say when do calls go up, we found from past practice that when we run television and print at the same time, the call volume goes up more dramatically. And it's running in state white papers. We do try to make sure our messages are targeted to diverse audiences. So, for example, there's one in the Scanner newspaper, so we run in community newspapers and try to reach a very broad audience. There's also website testimonials. This is a new feature that we put in place with this campaign. There are a series of four. There were actually four women that were interviewed during this process. All of them are Oregonian women in recovery. And the website testimonials each focus on a different question that people had that came up through research, is what's treatment like? What's it like picking up the phone? What's recovery like? So I do have an example of one of the testimonials. I don't know if you want to see it. It's a couple minutes long, or I can just let you know that it's there.
In terms of time, let's not do that, but maybe in a future presentation. Okay. That would be great.
And where that's posted right now is on the OregonLotteryHelp.org site. And this is a website that the Oregon Lottery creates and maintains. And it has a variety of information available. It's used statewide. It has warning signs. It has a quiz so that people can say, am I someone who may need help? It tells you how to talk to someone if you think someone you know has a problem. Does have some responsible gaming guidelines, and and the testimonials are on there as well. We're not going to play them right now, but just so you know that is there. So the next thing that we're working on is a second campaign that's designed to reach significant others of male problem gamblers, and there will be TV, radio, our TV, print, outdoor, other website testimonials, and also we'll be updating our posters and brochures. And just to show you an example of another support piece we have, these are current posters and brochures that are available at all of our retailers. They are required by contract to post this information. These are also distributed by DHS, by the prevention and treatment folks. This is essentially the materials that are used throughout the state. There's another set of brochures that are targeted to target populations such as seniors and youth that are distributed by DHS and produced by the Oregon Lottery. So just another piece of our outreach efforts. Also, we have a responsible gambling campaign that we talked a little bit about. It is developed using a public health care model, meaning that when we talk about a healthy player base, what we are saying is we want people who play to maintain healthy gambling habits, that if they're going to play games, they should set standards for themselves. The two that have proven effective in research are to set a time limit and set a budget. So that becomes the core of our message to the public around responsible gaming. The vision here is that you stop people from falling off the cliff, that if people have healthy play habits, hopefully they don't develop a gambling problem. So that really is, we've worked again closely with DHS to say what does that model look like. Some of the other features of our responsible gambling campaign is on every VLT, as Director Penn mentioned, there is a message that says, gambling too much, call for free help, available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's the 1-877 My Limit phone number, which takes you to the emergence service that's funded through a DHS contract funded with lottery dollars. We have time of day clocks on our video lottery terminals because we know losing track of time is one thing that people tend to do when they get too absorbed. This is a constant reminder that how long they've played and what time it is. And also credits, which are typically in a casino and used to be how we represented money, we've translated that into dollars and cents, so it's harder to lose track of. This is actually money that you're playing with. The other thing that I didn't mention on here is that we fully disclose all of the odds and payouts on our game. It is a statutory requirement on our advertising, but we put it out there to be transparent to our players about what the nature of a game of chance is.
How is that displayed?
Sure, for me, it's in a variety of methods on our video lottery terminals. If you go into the individual games, it will have odds and payout charts. If it's on our other games, they're printed on the tickets themselves. It's printed on our website, and it is tagged on our television, radio, print, and outdoor boards that lottery games should be played for entertainment, not investment purposes. If we have room, we also always put the odds and the payouts, such as in our print ads.
Okay, help me understand this. So on the video lottery, would it be come up on the video itself, or do they have to search for it?
Chair Tomei, the odds and payouts for the video games would be you'd have to go into the detail of a game to see them. It's simply because we have... it's not an easy representation on a video lottery game to say what the odds are, because the odds are going to vary depending on what part of the game you're in or what element of the game you're looking at. So it is there, but it's...
What is the potential of somebody actually searching for that information?
My understanding is that players go to those help screens fairly often because they want to understand what they're playing for, and it's simply the way that we have a menu-driven terminal so that they have that access to that game by game.
Madam Chair, I'll just share with you. I had a neighbor come up to me and say, well, so I see the lottery programs, line games at 92%. And he has a publication that tells him all these different locations and what the odds are and what the payout rates are. And so I think that's just kind of common knowledge besides. But that is what we do. And, he was very much aware of it.
Thank you.
Just to show you an example of what our responsible gambling campaign looks like, and I believe last time we addressed this committee, we were in the production of this campaign, and it has been on the air for about the past 6 months. There's a television ad that's trying to get people to understand when they may be playing too much and what the tools are they can use to manage their play.
Well, we probably better just keep going.
Yep.
It did display a gambler with kind of one head over here saying, gee, you're playing too long, and oh, no, we're going to hit the jackpot. And so it was trying to emphasize.
Well, we'll show you the print. It may ring a bell if you've seen the television ad. It's essentially a guy with his conscience arguing about should he go home or should he stay. So again, this is another one of our efforts that's directed toward responsible gaming. The last couple of slides just reiterate what I had already talked about with our retailer training program. We train 100% of new retailers. We train them on warning signs and their contractual obligations, which are to post problem gambling helpline materials, and that when they have a visibly intoxicated person, they need to not allow them to play lottery. So those are their current two contractual obligations. As I mentioned, we're working on a new training program, and it will not only will we expand the intervention techniques in it, but we're making it accessible for the retailers to show to their employees on site through a web-based training program. The last thing I just wanted to say on a note of where we're going from here in our partnership with DHS and Emergence, there is a new website that we are currently working on promoting, and it has the same web name as the phone number, so hopefully there'll be recognition that it's 1-877-MyLimit.org. It will have a lot of the information that is on the Oregon Lottery Help site. We're actually trying to move people to go to this site rather than ours, because some people think it's odd to go to an Oregon Lottery site. This is a more generic site, so we're going to duplicate a lot of the information. And the most cool thing about it, I think, is this live chat feature. So people, particularly women, and research, when we ask them, responded very positively to a chat feature, because someone who may not want to pick up the phone and get in a conversation might feel comfortable doing it online, particularly if it's someone who's already used to being online. It may remove a barrier. So we're going to be working to promote that chat feature in our advertising as well. So that's kind of an overview of our efforts. Any questions we can answer for you?
Great. Yes, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. It's good to see the update from the session.
On the retailer training program and the contractual obligations, so a contractor, again, this is primarily the bars and restaurants with the video versus someone who sells scratches at the convenience store, right? So they post the materials, and they're not supposed to let drunk folks play. Are you going to add to the contractual obligations the web-based module for training employees?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, as we are designing that, that's something that we have discussed, and we haven't finalized that, and one of our methods we thought would be to have retailers identify themselves as someone who has taken a big step on responsible gaming. And that's one way they could do that. All of their employees have gone through this. We don't have any options on the contract until 2010 to make it an obligation to increase their responsibilities. But that's something we would discuss. I think our discussions right now is let's have kind of a certification program. Let's have it be a badge of honor. Let's have a retailer be able to say in the community, I've taken a step in this approach. So that's at least our discussions right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's very interesting. I hope you pursue that as the idea to have some kind of stamp of approval on the door saying I'm a responsible gambler. And, you know, I know neighborhoods in my area would like to know who are the responsible gamblers because we have places that are basically mini casinos. And then we have places that people hang out, drink, maybe play a little video lottery, and then they go home. You know, so there are different places in our neighborhood. So I would encourage you to pursue that. I think that's a great idea.
Any other questions? Cully, this is an issue that I think that is very important to me and I hope to the committee. And if you have further questions, we may have time during the February session to have any follow-up on this. So if you come up with any questions, if you'd let Rick or me know, then we can pass them out to whomever should be following up on this, and maybe we'll have another hearing. So thank you so much.
Thank
we really
you.
Appreciate it. Doing more work.
Thank you.
So... before we end up our session, anything else you
forget? Madam Chair, I just want to remind staff that if they continue to ask more interesting questions than members, they could end up in the back of the room with other.
Thank you.
And lastly, this may be my last meeting with the committee. As you know, there's been a lot of developments in my district, and Saturday we meet to choose a new senator, and if there is a groundswell of unanimous support, I will be back.
Madam Chair, are you responding to this?
Along that same vein.
Okay.
I was just wondering, Representative Gilliam, in the last presentation there was information about credible messengers and actors and not actors. Do you know, was your face shared in that... in that survey?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you, Representative. I was offended by the comments by the lottery about the possibility that actors might be able to portray. But my respect for them allowed me not to say anything. And, yeah, I do resemble the three faces that you saw. Thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry to change the topic here.
No,
but
you're not.
Has the chair decided on the informational sessions for February? Are we still collecting? Are you still collecting?
Yes, we're still collecting.
Okay, and so okay.
Yes. So yes, for anybody who hasn't, I think you've given me a pretty good list to start out with. But we'll entertain others also, and certainly we'll be having hearings on the two bills that we sent out today. So I'm very excited about that. I think the committee's done a great job. So thank you. Anything else for the good of the order? All right. Thank you all very much. Thank you if you're in the audience. And we'll close the House Interim Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness.